across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late nights on Talk Radio.
Well, I hope he's there, because otherwise I've got a whole year of unexplained shows to fill. And if he's not there, then we're going to be a bit thin on the ground. Howard Hughes here, Happy New Year. I'm with Bestie Bessie tonight. Bessie is my new bestie. She's my producer for the night. Until this week, Bessie, we'd never worked before. True?
I know,
together?
It's the first time working together.
Well, actually, we'd never worked before, but that's a whole other story. So, you know, we're kind of getting into the flow here. We'll hear from you tonight, whatever you want to talk about, as I think, did I tweet today? Maybe I forgot to tweet, but I did put on my Facebook. 0344-499-1000 is the number that you need for us here. You can tweet us on the Twitter, at Talk Radio. If you want to text us, you can text Talk and then a space and your message to 87222. And we'll kind of, I don't know, we'll walk it as best we can. And now, Bessie, look, it's lovely to see you here tonight.
Thank you. It's rare. I'm often behind the screen, so it's rare that I get my chance in front of the mic.
Well, you see, there are so many people in this industry who would say to Howard Hughes, you know, he was integral to my career.
Exactly. You launched me.
You may well be in future years when you're on the telly doing Good Morning Great Britain or whatever you're going to be doing or whatever. You'll say, well, Howard Hughes gave me a chance to go behind the microphone. You know,
test my newspaper reviewing skills.
And you could, you know, had a chance to try out your gilded tones here, which is part of the thing. We were having a talk, and sometimes those talks in the office that you have with your producer or whoever's, you know, involved around the show can give birth to a whole idea that gets you going on something else. I came in and, all right, was I having a moan? Maybe. And maybe I was having a moan.
It was a bit of a moan.
only slightly. Just that there are so many news stories around every day, right? You've only got to look at the newspapers, full of them. But if you listen to the electronic media, look at the electronic media today, the only things that supposedly we're talking about are, rightly, we're talking about the fires in Australia. We have to keep an eye on that, and it's getting more worrying because the temperatures are getting higher. They're going to go even higher into the 40s tomorrow. I don't know if you know that, but it's going to be worse there. So our thoughts with, you know, my Australian listeners to The Unexplained who might be joining us tonight, and thoughts with you. The future of the Labour Party, which I have heard discussed in various places, in much the same way, about 12 times today. And, you know, it's the same people they suggest. You know, we know about Keir Starmer, there are people suggesting Diane Abbott, and a whole catalogue of other people who could potentially be leaders of the Labour Party. But I have news for the people who are discussing this today. I think at the moment, people are still in holiday mode. And, you know, we could do with hearing a few other stories, was my thought about that. Rail fare rises, I can understand why that's being talked around today. But again, a story that is in the Evening Standard in London, the evening newspaper here, that is, I think, is a great story, but was not done, I don't
completely
think...
completely passed me by.
Exactly. And, you know, it's here on the front page of the Standard. And this is going to mean something to you if you are a user of South Western Railways, which is like the suburbs of London, but also right down to the southwest coast, down to Dorset anyway, at least. And as far as Portsmouth, Fareham, Winchester, all of those places. And they've had a strike. I don't know whether you've heard about this, but for the last month, the guards have been on strike. It's a row basically about crewing. The guards want to be able to operate the doors of the trains and to give them a safety critical function that they are responsible for. And it's a dispute that's ongoing, and, you know, various people have various views as to whether South Western Railway have done as much as they might have to get the talks, you know, on track. This strike has happened. But the strike ended, okay, so it's ended or is in the process of ending. But apparently, and the top line of this story is hundreds of London commuter trains were, and, you know, throughout their area, I presume, were axed because staff who've been on strike for a month have told that they have to be retrained in safety before they can go back to work.
So much time off.
Because, well, it's not, I mean, you know, let's not get involved in the pluses and minuses, the ins and outs and ups and downs of the strike. But I don't understand that. That needs explaining. And it's the job of the media to do that. But that's just by the by, really. There's a whole ton of other stories that have been around today that I haven't heard people talking about. And we've both been looking at them. For example, the Daily Mirror today. Now, if you're one of my friends in Liverpool, you might...
Oh, here we go.
Well, no, not necessarily. I'm not going to lapse into it. But, you know, there's, you know, if the moment arises, then we'll do it. According to the Daily Mirror today... Liverpool people are top of the league for being love cheats, according to a survey. Is that so? Well, tell me, look, I'm a Scouser. I'm many years, I'm constant as the Northern Star, me. Is that true? How do they get this data as well?
Is it a survey where you fill
in? Well, I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? I don't know how they get that.
How do they find out?
Because if you ask people, are they going to tell you what they really do? I don't know. Maybe just Liverpool people were more honest.
Maybe that's what it is.
Liverpool people, what do you think? If you're listening, if you're one of my friends in Liverpool, then tell us what you think. You know, I think we're just honest. That's all we are, really.
Well, so there's a similar story in a similar vein, where apparently drivers of a Renault are the randiest.
Really?
They're the most likely to become, what's the word, romantic in the car.
Well,
yeah.
The only Renaults
More
I can
remember.
More than
half of them admitted, okay. 56% admitted to getting intimate in their car.
Well, the Renaults I remember got no room for any of that stuff.
I know. And BMW came second.
And they used to have the gear stick in a funny place, which would rule out all of that, don't you? No, they did. They did. They had a gear stick that would come and would, you know, put an end to your Fandango.
I can imagine, yes.
Okay. So...
already gone. We're only a couple of minutes in.
Are we inviting people to... I don't know, but whatever. do you have a Renault and have you, you know, got amorous in the Renault? You know, I'm sure if Ian Lee was here, he'd give you the full words. Well, I'm not doing that.
We're going to, yes.
Okay.
It's only just got 10.
And then there's the usual old tripe about shivery start to 2020 in the Daily Mail today. We were lucky enough to enjoy a dry, mild evening as the clock struck midnight. But don't be fooled, says the Daily Mail. The trouble is that when newspapers do this, they give the, it's a what they call a hostage to fortune, right? They will say, it's usually the Express who does this, and they say it's going to get really cold. I don't know. I don't think it is. Don't be fooled. Temperatures are expected to plummet this week. Weekend as winter weather returns to normal. Well, that's fine. I'll believe that if I see it. And what else have you got then, Bessie? Bestie?
What else have I got? Oh, here's
Bessie,
one.
Bessie, my bestie. That's what you're going to be now. Sorry.
Snowflakes like myself, I'm assuming they mean the millennials, are flocking to farms for meditative experiences with sheep. So you can have an afternoon at an Airbnb with sheep. So in the home, you can have a cream tea with them, you can just spend time with them, and apparently it's supposed to be very relaxing.
Do they call it a meditative experience?
Yes, a meditative, struggle to say that one, experience.
Okay, I mean, sheep are very placid.
They're very calm creatures.
Well, they are, and you can, I once sheared a sheep.
Really?
I did, I worked on loads of radio stations, some of them in the country, and they used to have to cover these agricultural shows, and they said, Howard, would you like to shear the sheep? So I'm thinking, I'm going to get covered in poo. If I do this, you know, that's my first thought.
Even where my mind was, how do you even grab hold of a sheep?
Well, no, because, you know, the top side is normally all right.
Yes.
The underside tends to drag along the mud and stuff and does accumulate a certain amount of fecal matter. I think you might be, well, I'm just, you know, everyone has to be honest about these
things. Going through all the bodily functions.
So you have to be able to, when you're shearing them, the guy says, now all you have to do is, there are the clippers, you can't go wrong with those, there's the button that does the whole thing here. So you put your arm around the sheep's two front arms and they drop down there, right?
Okay,
you can't see this, but you drop down there. And then you go zzz, up and down with the shearers. And the sheep is placid, is not kicking, is not screaming. Even I could do that. Isn't that amazing?
Would you let sheep into your home then, do you think?
No, because they poo everywhere. No, the privilege normally reserved only for myself. I'm kidding when I say that. 0344 499 1000 is our number. Have you got any more stories then? That should have been, I mean, the point of what I'm saying here is that there is more to life at the moment than who is going to lead the Labour Party next. Of course it's an important story. But is it such an important story that everybody has to be talking about it all the way across Christmas, right up until this evening? I don't know, really.
Yeah.
Can't we pick that up on Monday? Don't you think so? Because we've been through Brexit and people's families splitting apart and people chewing bits out of each other because of arguments to do with Brexit. Then we had the election and all of the, you know, acrimony about that. And then we had the vote. And then we had, like, you know, during a ceasefire in World War One, everything went quiet over Christmas.
Well, you're not allowed to bring it up at my family Christmas.
Really?
We banned it all from the table.
Why are you a split family then? Family at war?
It's just not worth even, we had a family party with all the relatives, so both cousins, everyone, and we're all from different parts of the country as well, so... Without doubt, people are going to have different views. So
really?
We all said, me and my cousins, we had a group chat on Facebook, and we all said, can we promise not to bring up politics? And if anyone does, there's going to have to be some sort of forfeit.
I have to honestly,
and we
truly,
made it through the night. We
genuinely say that after the 3 years of it that we've had, and then leading up to the election, I think, and I've done, you know, let's not bore people with the story of me having done news for years, but I think people are just sick of it now. They've had it. Yeah. They want it stopped. At least, you know, maybe we'll be all right to talk about these things in a week or two. But for the moment, you know, most people found refuge in Christmas, I think.
We're only just recovering.
Yeah. Now, New Year resolutions. I was going to fire this one past you tonight. Not that we're going to be doing, like, topics and, you know, you talk about tonight, we're talking about this. It's not really about that. But if you had a New Year resolution that you made, maybe on the spur of midnight, and you've already broken it, tell me what it was and how you came to err. Okay, I'm very keen to know that. I'll tell you about mine in a bit, but I haven't started.
Have you already
started,
broken one?
No, I haven't started it yet. That's where I
that's
scored.
That's cheating.
No, it's not.
That's
it's not.
Cheating.
It's not. I mean, if I've been working across the holiday, there's method to it, okay? Or are you still sticking to a New Year's resolution that you made last year? If so, we want to hear from you because you are in a big minority or a small minority, I suggest, whichever of the two is more applicable. Our number here, 0344-499-1000, whatever you want to talk about, really. If you want my unexplained listeners, and thank you very much for all of the nice feedback on my Facebook page that you sent me to do with me coming on here tonight. Your support has been gratefully received tonight. You don't know anything about this, bestie, do you?
I know about the unexplained.
No, I know you know about it.
Your core listeners, no, because I've not had the pleasure of working on the show yet.
Oh, it's a pleasure indeed it is.
Question is, has Alan called in yet?
He's just about to do it. Can I just say to my unnamed listener, I'm very sorry to hear about your cat. If you want a shoulder to cry on, we're both here tonight.
You had a great cat story. The cat in the car.
This is one that, sorry, it sounds like we're just reading stories out of the paper now, which of course we would never do. Daily Mail is essentially somebody who drove 130 miles from Birmingham to East London, I think. From Birmingham to East London. You do all the whole range of accents and available for voice work once this run of
shameless
Christmas work
plug
ends. Then I will be available for anything, I think. And usually am. Essentially the story is a cat that got itself into the engine bay of a car and went for 130 miles and lived to tell the tale. Now they're trying to find it. I think that's the essence of the story. Yeah. And the driver realized he had a stowaway on board only when he pulled up outside a block of flats and people told him they could hear meowing. The Celia Hammond Animal Trust. We've been trying to get in touch with them. If you're listening, I'd be very keen to talk with you about that because they're trying to relocate that cat. And it would be nice if we could be instrumental in making that happen.
Remember we were talking about earlier about good news and putting the good news line first. I guess the top line there is cat survives traveling.
Yeah, no,
how
exactly.
How many miles is it? 130.
No, I'm a great exponent of good news because I think there's too much bad news. And I spent most of my professional career, 20 years or more, doing it. And yeah, I'm trying to prostrate myself in front of you at the moment and redress the balance somewhat. If
maybe
we can.
For the next 3 hours we can have take shelter
who
from
knows. So it's me, it's Alex on the controls. Bestie, my producer, and Alan Caddick in Birmingham. Now, we've got to do the big intro because we've been doing it over Christmas, and I'm only doing two more days of this. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Alan Caddick.
I like John Thoris and Take the Morse. New comedy like Adrian Lowe with his Lulu of a Mom. New plays, big films, documentaries, new series. Even Max Headroom interviews. And this week you can check your winning lines, get your mother Rolls Royce, a frame chain when you buy this pendant, and a holiday bonus worth up to £200. In TV time, the bargain of the year.
Evening, Alan Caddick. You've excelled you. So what year was that then, Alan? Let me tell you.
From the 50s of 1987.
Was it really? So we skipped a year because we did 85 the year. You know nothing of this, bestie, do you?
No.
Okay, we skipped a year. We did 85. And I couldn't hear some of that, Alan. What was the prize in the TV Times?
It was winning lines with £50,000 worth of prizes.
Okay, wow. £50,000 worth of prizes in 1987.
How much is that now?
That would probably be at least 300K these days, I would think.
And on the front cover, it was John Thor and Kevin Whateley.
Oh, right. John Thor and Kevin Whateley. What were they in?
Inspector Morse.
They were doing Morse. A Morse, of course. And here you go, Alan. You know everything. What was Morse's, and we only found out at the end of the series, what was his middle name?
No, his first name, you mean.
His first name.
Endeavour.
Endeavour?
Endeavour.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big spoiler because I've never watched it.
Well, you need to. It's
great
acting.
You've ruined it for me now.
Great classic acting, even if I couldn't remember what his first name was. So what's going on with you then, Alan?
Well, the decorations are down in my house because we'll pack it up for another year.
Okay. The decorators are in because you're packing up for another year.
The decorations are down.
Oh, no, you've taken them down already.
Okay.
We'll pack it up for another year.
Oh, right. And have you got boxes? And my parents used to have boxes and boxes of stuff that they would bring out every Christmas.
We've got three boxes.
Have you? And what's in the boxes then? You've got lights, you've got tinsel, well, you've got balls for the tree.
Yeah, we've got the baubles and garlands in one box. Mm-hmm. And the second box, we've got the lights and the ceiling decorations.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third box, full of Christmas teddies.
Teddies.
Aww.
That's really nice.
Teddies.
That's right, and you know, they get you, they're there for 2 weeks of the year, and then they're just gone.
We've got a dog that farts.
Have you got a dog? I think a lot of people have got those. Depends on what are you feeding him?
No, it was a toy dog.
Oh, it's a toy dog that farts.
Oh, it's a toy dog, God.
I watched a great video, you've got to see this. David Letterman, great American TV talk show host, classic. You know the guy from, oh God, I met him and I interviewed him, I forgot his name now. The guy who did the Naked Gun movies.
Leslie Nielsen.
Oh, yeah.
Leslie Nielsen goes on the Letterman talk show and he's sitting there. You know, Letterman has a big desk and a microphone. Yeah, yeah. Says, oh, well, Leslie Nielsen. Leslie Nielsen is the loveliest man. Okay, when I met him, he was so, I'll tell you what he did in just a second. He sat there and he had a fart machine with him. And so he was being asked questions by Letterman and every so often he'd go like that. You know, if I could reach that level, I'd be a happy man. But it's a must-see video. The way that I've described it is just not...
I bet that was quite a bloke.
Well, there's a bit of that, yes. Not that we do gags of that nature here, you know.
Leave that till Monday when Ian's back.
Exactly.
Leave that where it belongs.
Do the fart gags when Ian's... Mind you, we've got a comic coming on soon to talk about something completely different, Alan.
Oh, it's
a
whole other story.
No, you have to wait and find out.
Is it going to be on after 11?
No. It's coming actually within minutes from now, Alan. So all you have to do is stay awake for another 15 minutes and you'll hear this person.
Ooh,
he's very funny. Amazing. You might pick up some comedy tips from him. In fact, I might pick up some comedy tips from him. Hey, listen, Alan, thank you very much for supporting me over these nights. Only one more to do tomorrow night, and then I'm just a blip in the sky.
Well, at least you'll be on Sunday with the unexplained.
Well, of course, there's the unexplained on Sunday. But, you know, we're a bit more focused there. We've got, you know, people to get through and stories to tell. So it's just been nice to sit here and talk a load of old rollocks.
Chew the fat.
Exactly. Precise, as you put it so elegantly. Hey, Alan, have a good night. We'll talk again. Bye-bye.
This is it, bye.
Alan Caddick there, here at Talk Radio. If you want to chew the fat... If you've got anything to say, if you've got a New Year resolution that you started and you're pursuing with it, if you lasted 5 hours because somebody tempted you and you rose to the temptation, 0344-499-1000 or on the Twitter at Talk Radio, or you can text us, text Talk and then a space in your message to 87222. Well, that's all I'm going to say for now. It's myself, Howard Hughes, and Bestie here on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late nights on Talk Radio.
Classic hits and the best of today. We are Talk Radio. Howard Hughes here. Alex doing the technical stuff for us. And Bestie, my producer. It's just the three of us and you. Here on Talk Radio. Well, that's the general aim round here. Now, in the news today, and generally being talked about over the holiday period, is the trend to more and more people completely giving up meat, either going vegetarian. Or going, this is probably not the right way of putting it, but going the whole hog and going vegan. And, you know, eschewing everything, going the whole hog. It's brilliant, that. Thank you, Howard. Going the whole hog and going vegan. And even, just before I came in here, I read that the Golden Globes are going to be offering more than just a smorgasbord of vegan delights for the Golden Globes here. Fronted by Ricky Gervais this year. They're having him back. I love Ricky Gervais. Redding's finest he is. But, I don't know, Ricky Gervais and a vegan event, as it may be, the Golden Globes. Is that going to work? Somebody who may be able to help us carve our way through this is Carl Donnelly. I've got here on my piece of paper, the world's funniest vegan. Well, there's only one who we're talking to. Carl, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. I've never been called that before, but I'll take it.
Doesn't veganism... not compute with being funny? How do you do that? A vegan, because you're a vegan comic, yeah?
I am, yeah, I'm a stand-up comedian. I think it, I reckon it used to be. There's definitely generational vegans in terms of, like, when I first went vegan, a lot of the community were, you know, your stereotypical old hemp trouser wearing, you know, dreadlocks. Yeah, that sort of type of vegan, I think most people assume me are. And actually, in the time I've been doing it, loads of people, loads of comedians are now. Ramesh Ranganathan's vegan, and Sarah Pascoe, and I think Ricky Gervais is vegetarian, isn't he? Is that, am I right?
Is he? Oh, top man. I've always, do you know, I've always wanted to do it. But I've just never had I've never had the courage, never had the fortitude, really, to see it through.
I think it can be quite daunting for people. I think the way I did it was trying to change how I thought about it, as like, rather than it being more hassle than my current life or my life before, it was actually removing things. So I sort of tried to look at it as a simplification, which it ultimately isn't, because you end up having to eat loads of weird new things. But it's sort of I think what puts people off is the hassle involved.
Well, that's it. You know, anything that involves cooking tends to make me run a mile, unless you can do it in the microwave. If they start doing vegan food that you can microwave, I think Marxies has got some, then, you know, I might be on board with that.
But that's the big thing now. Like, when I did it, it was actually quite hard to get vegan fast foods. But in the last few years, I mean, even today, Greg's released a vegan steak bake, and it's caused a national meltdown online.
Oh, my God. And didn't Greg's do a pasty, a vegan pasty?
They did a sausage roll last year, and it caused equal amounts of disdain from most of the British public.
So are you a comic and a vegan, or a vegan comic?
Well, I was a comedian before I was vegan, and so it's something I sort of introduced. And I talk about it on stage on and off, but I think I tend to talk about it in quite a flippant way that doesn't put people off. You know, I'm quite self-deprecating about my life.
But are there vegans? I mean, I was being flippant when I said the vegans don't have a sense of humour. I mean, I'm sure that they do, but is there such a thing as a vegan joke? Could you say a vegan walks into a bar, guy behind the bar says, you know, why the vegetarian face? You see what I'm saying? Doesn't work. Certainly not for me.
I mean, I think I tend to, most of the stuff when
the cauliflower ears.
I tend to stick to, like, little stories about when it's got me into some sort of spot of bother. Like, I often mind my family for it. My family are, like, old working class Irish people. So, like, the amount of exchanges I've had with them that have been so tiring because they can't understand it that leads to about 20 minutes of material a year.
But I suppose it's the thing, and I would be guilty of this too, I suppose, that it's, if you aren't actually a vegan, if you're not actually committed to it, then you don't quite understand what those vegans do. So I suppose that's the same with your parents. It's a basic misunderstanding.
Totally, yeah, and I've never ever begrudged them for it. I mean, they're from a totally different generation, you know, I think, and that's the thing with most vegans, actually, are really chilled, you know. I think the reputation of them being quite angry and, you know, combative, I think, that you're always going to hear the loudest voices, whereas most of us would just do it and, you know, we'd sort of don't push it in your faces.
Mm. Have you got a vegan, it's really unfair this, but have you got a vegan, I know you've just come off stage at the Comedy Store, have you got a vegan joke for us?
I haven't got a vegan joke. There's a bit I do on stage sometimes, which I think gets across one of the annoying questions we get asked, which is, a lot of people ask where we get our protein from. And what I've started doing is just lying to people, and I've worked out that no one knows where they get any protein from. Because basically, recently somebody asked me where I get my protein from, and I just told them I get mine off a mate, and they just believed it. So I realised it's all a con.
You just have to know the right people. You phone a number, and there's the protein.
That's it. We've got protein dealers on every corner.
And are you doing? I mean, you're doing something to promote Veganuary, if that's how you pronounce it, Vegan January.
Yeah, well, I've been. It's called Veganuary. It's a little campaign. I think it's quite good because they time it really well for that start of the year when people want to try something new. So they challenge people to do it for a month, and I've been an ambassador of theirs for a few years. And this year I'm doing a show on the 15th with Cauldron, which is like a quite well-known vegan food brand. Basically, any vegans or vegetarians listening, that will be their go-to tofu that they buy, which is like our food that everyone laughs at.
No, I've seen those in the supermarket, and I have to say, because it's a bit scary to me. I don't know what it's all about. I tend to walk quickly past it, and I shouldn't.
I think it's scary because British cuisine doesn't use it. A lot of Asian cuisine uses it, and they know how to cook with it, but I think British people see it just as like a white blob. So once you learn to cook with it, it's actually very nice. But yeah, we're doing a gig on the 15th with Cauldron to sort of celebrate Veganuary and spread the word.
Oh, you know, you make me feel really guilty because I once discovered the delights of tofu. And tofu is one of those things, isn't it? And most, again, people who still do meat and eat an ordinary diet don't necessarily appreciate this. But tofu takes up the flavor of whatever you put with it. So if you want to make it taste like, you know, beef teriyaki, or you want it to taste like chicken, then tofu will take up the flavor.
Totally. Yes, it's so plain.
We'll be talking about this tonight.
It sounds pretty, like, critical to say, but it's literally not got a flavor itself, really. So, you know, whereas most meats have a flavor that will overpower, you know, you have to really flavor it right. Tofu, yeah, it's like, that's a blank page.
Yeah. Now, you do something that I have total admiration for, and that is to stand up in front of people, you know, at the Comedy Store and make them laugh. It will hopefully make them laugh. You know, I could not do that to save my life. I've had to stand in front of big audiences, and I learned over the years how to do that. But I couldn't tell gags. I would have no idea how to do that. Is that not the single most scary experience of your life?
Do you know what? It sounds like it will be, but it genuinely is a different muscle than, like, normal public speaking. Because it basically is, comedy is about tricking an audience into thinking you're having a conversation when you're actually just having a one-way conversation. Mm-hmm. So it's more, I think, a skill that some people either naturally have or they learn. But I think radio is really hard. You know, that sort of, again, you do that one-way conversation thing, but you can't actually hear a response in the moment. So
the great thing about radio, though, and I'm sure you will do radio at some point, because you've got a very easy style about you, and you would be great for it. But the one thing about radio is, if your audience on the particular night or day wants to lynch you, they can't get anywhere near you, right? But no. If you are on the stage somewhere and you are trying to make them laugh and they're not going for it, then they are about 10 feet from you, if you're lucky.
But that's also the thrill of it, the fact that it can go so wrong. Like, I mean, I've been quite lucky. Like, December's normally the worst month for comedians because every gig is full of Christmas parties. And I saw some gigs that were on the cusp of being absolute carnage. Like, I witnessed a woman quit her job at her Christmas party.
Oh, my God. I mean, look, obviously we want to protect her anonymity here. How did she do that? Did she just stand up and say, that's it, I'm out of here?
No, she was really drunk, went to the bathrooms and vomited, got caught by the bouncers coming out, basically having just vomited everywhere. And they told her boss, like, you know, I think she needs to leave. And the boss really kindly said to her, I think you should go home for your own safety.
Oh,
I'll get the taxi.
Dear.
And she just took it that he was trying to get rid of her and quit on the spot. I mean, I can only imagine how she felt the next morning.
Well, if that person, there's a slim chance, but who knows, if that person, and you will know who you are, is listening now, I'm hoping very much that that story had a happy ending.
Because
if the boss was as nice as you say he was, then he would have understood that she was a little tired and emotional. It was Christmas. It's been a long year. And who knows? Who knows?
I think I've seen a lot of Christmas party drinking. I actually think that's probably a more common experience than than we'd expect. I'm sure a lot of bosses have had to deal with that on a Friday.
Oh, I would have thought so. A quick indicator of what level we've reached. Our friend Hedy here, one of our tweeters here at Talk Radio, friend of my show, friend of me, suggests that Jasper Carrot was a vegan.
Oh, really?
I think
I actually fell for that.
It's the way I do. I think it's the way I tell him.
I mean, yeah, you should deliver that like it was a genuine fact.
Jasper Carrot. I'm going to have to. That's why I can't be a comedian, and that's why you can't. Why you can. When you go home when you go home from a big gig like the one you've done tonight at the Comedy Store, what does a vegan eat? What will you make?
I mean, to be honest, I'm trying at the minute. I'm in the classic cliche January diet where I'm trying to eat a lot less and not drink and stuff. So I'm going to try and not eat when I get home. But normally, I mean, I'd probably just stick to a classic bit of toast with Marmite or something like that.
Mm.
It's actually most of the normal staples of the diet, your breads and pastas and things, are all fine. It's just take out meat and cheese, you're fine.
I didn't ask you, should have. It just shows how good a broadcaster I am. was it a good gig tonight? Did you leave them rolling in the aisles?
Yeah, the Comedy Store. I mean, if anyone lives in London, you know, you should get down to the Comedy Store. It's sort of I'd say the home of, you know, British stand-up, you know, of the last 30 years.
So many people started there, and it's such a it's such a test.
And it's quite a daunting gig. Like, I was hosting it tonight, and I mean, like, when you walk in, you walk through the sort of hallway, and there's photos of all these legends. It's quite a daunting moment to be like, I need to live up to these people.
And you get, you know, there's the famous story about Robin Williams being in the audience one night, and somebody was appearing on stage and realised that Robin Williams was there listening to him. And you get famous people in the audience.
Now and again, I've never had that. I'm trying to say, I've had a few. Often you get sports people in gigs, or, I mean, weirdly, the most starstruck, I remember when I was quite new to comedy, it was about 2008, I think I was doing a show, and Denise Van Outen was in the crowd. And I was, she's like, you know, I was like 15 years old when she was hosting the Big Breakfast. And I was so in love with her as a teenager that it totally threw me when I saw her in the crowd.
I was going to say, was she putting you off?
Absolutely, yeah. Just, yeah, she was, I mean, I turned into like a 15-year-old boy.
I had that experience once when I had to interview Michaela Strachan, but that says an awful lot about me, I guess. Now, do you know Bob Mills? Are you a friend of Bob Mills?
I do know. Yeah, I've known Bob for years.
Because you need to come on his show here on Talk Radio if you haven't been on yet.
Yeah, I've been on a couple of times,
right,
I think.
You need to come back.
He's a funny man. He was one of my heroes when I first, when I was young. I used to watch his TV show, In Bed With Me Dinner.
He's a great guy. Don't mess with Bob Mills. Now, Carl Donnelly, thank you very much and Happy New Year. Thanks for talking with us. And, you know, Happy Veganuary.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Carl Donnelly, fresh off the stage, doing something that I couldn't do to save my life, right? You know, I can barely do a radio show. Now, opinions will be divided about that. But the idea of going on, you know, you've got a dark stage and then you've got 400 people or more all waiting to be made amused. I just couldn't do that. You know, I would probably forget what I was going to say next. And that would not be good comedy. Who knows? Maybe one day I'll try it. Who knows? And I'll invite you. How about that? Howard Hughes here on Talk Radio in the night time on whatever night this is. It's a Thursday night, isn't it? Into Friday. With the team here tonight, working with different people all the way through the holidays. So tonight, it's Bestie, my producer, a.k.a. Bessie. And it's Alex doing the technical production. And it's me, Howard Hughes, the one constant in the middle of it all. Stay with us.
Outspoken opinions and decisive debate. Late nights on Talk Radio.
Oh, 0344-499-1000. Have I got a story for you? I can't believe he's played this. Have a listen. Okay, before we get to your calls, 0344-499-1000. Years and years ago, most of my stories are years ago, and you probably, if you've heard me doing this before, you will have heard me tell this story before. The only band I have ever introduced on stage is this one, Top Loader. Or as we used to call them back in the day, Front Loader, and they had that hit Dancing in the Moonlight, which is, you know, neither here nor there, really. But for the fact that totally randomly, and somebody up there, I think, my unexplained listeners will understand this, is somebody up there is trying to give me a message. I step into the lift in this building tonight thinking, what fate awaits me for the 3 hours between 10 and 1 o'clock? And the first tune that plays in the lift is that one. I walk in here tonight, and the third tune that Alex, my technical operative tonight, plays, without knowing any of that, is that one. Maybe there's a message in there. God knows what it might be, though. let's get to our friend Angela. Angela, how are you keeping tonight?
I'm keeping all right, Howard. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you for coming on tonight, Angela. You must have seen my message on Facebook saying, unexplained listeners, we love you. Will you?
Yeah, I did. I was just following Twitter. I was just following some of the football and that.
Have I missed? Is there a big football match on that I didn't know about?
Liverpool was on tonight on BBC.
Oh, God, that's my... Well, that's my team. Did they win?
Yeah, 2-0.
Who were they playing?
I ain't got a clue.
Okay, but Liverpool won. That's all that matters, really. Who were they playing? Alex? Sheffield United, says Alex, my technical producer. Well, there you go. Sorry, Sheffield. Up the Reds, eh? My father was a dyed-in-the-wool, lifelong Liverpool supporter right up until his dying day. We even had to get, when he was in a care home, the one thing that he asked, please, could we do for him, was to give him LFC TV. So in his last couple of months, he had LFC TV. You didn't ring for that reason, Angela. What are you up to anyway tonight?
I'm just I was just been thinking. I don't know, it's a bit hard at night time, isn't it? And I was thinking,
I find it hard all the time thinking.
And me, we got we've got a new door for my bathroom. We kicked the old council one out because it's doing my head in. So
you've got a new door for your bathroom?
Yeah.
Did they fit it today?
No, we did it.
Oh, you did it yourself?
Yeah, we asked permission and all that rubbish, and he said, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, no, that sounds a little technical for me, that.
We got it on New Year's Eve because my friend had a spare door that would fit it. It's fine.
You just happen to have a spare door? Funny you should say that. I've just got a spare door for your bathroom, and here it is. Okay.
Yeah, it looks lovely now. Just looked nice. I'm going to modern the flat up. I was thinking, if the building's old, it attracts older spirits.
Well, I suppose so. I wonder if your bathroom door is haunted by the spirits of people who've used that bathroom before.
They have found it was haunted, the bathroom. Someone died in the bathroom many years ago.
Oh, God. Well, no, I mean, look, we don't want to be, we don't want to be macabre or whatever that word is. But a lot of people do actually expire in the bathroom. Elvis Presley died in the bathroom.
Yeah, he did, didn't he?
He was on the loo, I think. But, you know, it is a common place for people to expire.
I think, yeah.
Best keep out of the bathroom then. So have you got spirits in your bathroom then? Have you got spectres in your taps? And ghouls in your system?
Yeah, well, we've got new,
Sorry,
we've got new everything now.
Okay.
And, trying to modern the flat up a little bit.
God, well, if you can do mine next. My flat is like something from the early 1980s. And when I moved into it, which is like years ago, I meant to stay 5 years and then leave, but a combination of being poor and working very hard meant that I didn't leave. I've got to do all of that. I've got to have new bathroom, new kitchen, boiler. Time for the boiler to say goodbye. I've got to do all of that.
Yeah, you've got to watch those boilers because they can be quite dangerous.
Oh, no, I have mine checked out every year. Mm. And we have the same conversation every year. The guy says, you know, it's about that time. It's about £2,000, but take them 3 days. And I say, well, can it just, another 6 months, please, until I can afford it, if I ever can. So, listen, did you help with the fitting of the new bathroom door then?
No, I just watched.
Did you? Okay. And was it an easy procedure? Because you've got to line it up with the holes in the door frame.
Well, it wasn't that easy because this block is because it was built in the 60s. The workmen weren't very brilliant. It was it's off. You feel like you've got a vertigo problem in the air. Do you know what I mean? It's like off. I don't know.
Oh, you're so far. What? You're so far up the building.
Yeah, you could say that.
How many floors?
Well, we're on the top, because this is amazing.
So you've got a view then, have you? You've got a bit of a view going on.
Right. Yeah, especially my kitchen window.
Yes, penthouse suite in Leicester you've got.
Yeah, it's kind of active outside in the car park with different things going on.
Okay.
I prefer it than the TV, I would.
Yeah, well, I can totally understand that. But anyway, you got through Christmas because you phoned here a couple of times. And now can you believe that it's 2020, Angela? I mean, I have to keep looking.
I can't believe it. I was trying to work the maths out. I've been through some decades, haven't I?
Oh, I think we all have. We're holding, what was the great man saying? Holding back the years. That's what we're doing. Angela, listen, Happy New Year. We'll talk again soon. Tomorrow night is my last night. Okay. It's myself and Haley. It's myself and Haley versus the world tomorrow night. So spare us a thought. And the odd frostbit in the air. Angela in Leicester. Calling Talk Radio. We've been trawling through some of these stories that I think the rest of the media should have been doing over this period, and they haven't. So we're bringing them to you. It was part of my duty in the years when I used to work on loads of different music radio stations up and down the country doing the news at breakfast time, which was what they always used to put me on, including 10 years in London. I may have mentioned with Chris Tarrant. I'd always have to find stories that the others were not doing. And my aim in the day was to find all of the stories that the others were not doing but would be later in the day. And I would consider myself to be succeeding if I found the stories in the morning at 5 a.m. that I would hear at 5 p.m. on the other story, on the other stations like the BBC. And that's what we're going to be doing a little bit of that in a moment. Who is the person who sent it? Leslie Nielsen. Leslie Nielsen, lovely man. Leslie Nielsen had the fart machine on Terry Wogan's TV show, apparently, as well. And Linda Lusardi, there's a blast from the past, thought that he was actually letting off for real. No, I think they sounded quite artificial. I think we'll have to, maybe we'll get one of those. But I've got to tell you that story about Leslie Nielsen. I actually interviewed him. But what I did was that I pretended that he was a visiting professor of journalism from America. He put on a pair of dark glasses. And then in those days, I was working with a lot of DJs like Pat Sharp. So Leslie Nielsen put on a pair of dark glasses. And I said, Pat, is it all right if this visiting professor of journalism, Leslie, comes in? Pat, of course, knew immediately who he was, but he was such a nice man. Paula in Blackpool says, enjoying the show as always. Thank you, Paula. Tell your friends. Hope you'll have some of your stories. Well, there's always stories to share. You know, there's never not stories to share. Have a great 2020, Paula. Nice to hear from you. Coming next, one of those stories that we've kind of sniffed out in the papers here that didn't really get the amount of coverage that I think it should. It is a story for our times, and I'm not going to tell you what it is. I will tell you next, coming here on Talk Radio. Our number, 0344-499-1000. Be here.
Talk Radio. Get up to the minute developments of all the top stories. Late nights on Talk Radio.
We're caught in a trap. And by way of tribute, Elvis Presley. Just, I feel like it's a bit disrespectful, isn't it, really? Oh, I don't know. It's late at night. Doesn't matter. We told the story. We were talking about people who expired in the bathroom. Sadly, Elvis was one of them. And I think he was actually in the loo. Let's put it no finer than that. Jonathan, you see, it's true. A lot of people, I mean, it's just a fact. That's all we're doing. We're sharing a fact here that a lot of people expire. For some, there must be a medical reason. No, I don't want to be, well, actually, I'm very, if you're medical and you're listening to this, maybe you've been doing a shift in a hospital. Why is it that so many, look, I know, it's just one of those questions that, you know, you might ask in the pub. Maybe you don't ask it on the radio, but we should. And, you know, we're here to break new ground, is what I'm saying. Why do so many people die in the bathroom? Well, just, you know, I'm sure there must be a, you know, it's to do with the capillaries and all the rest of it. Jonathan, thank you for your story in Worthing and my deepest sympathy to you. And nice to know that you're there, by the way. Where else? Yes, thank you. Yes, anonymous texter who says that he sometimes gets the impression that somebody has died in your bathroom. That's a different thing. You need to change your diet. but don't go vegan just yet, for all our sakes. Okay. This is a, sorry, in the nighttime, Talk Radio, 0344-499-1000. We're up the level slightly now, we need to. One of those stories that you see and you think, how snowflake can you get? Okay, now, look, maybe I'm wrong about this. According to The Sun this morning, visitors have moaned that the Tower of London is not suitable for kids because of its bloody past. The quotes, snowflakes, this is according to the story, have even accused the yeoman warders, known as beefeaters, of being sexist. Among the reviews posted on the website TripAdvisor are gripes like torture artifacts that you see in a place like that. You know, the clue is in the name, the Tower of London. If you see a rack, if you see something bloody and gruesome from the past, that's because it's the Tower of London. If you don't want to see stuff like that, then I would respectfully suggest that you don't go there. But that's another one of those stories that was not picked up, it seems to me, by the rest of the mainstream media tonight. So let's correct that now. Let's talk with Mike Yardley, military historian. Mike, thank you very much for doing this tonight. Joking apart, can you believe that there are people who go to the Tower of London and see what it has to offer, appreciating the fact that it has a place in our history for various reasons, and then they think it's actually too gruesome for people to see? What do you make of that?
Well, I'm not surprised, but I am amazed. I mean, I've got quite a long association with the Tower of London myself, and indeed I can remember as a kid trucking along to the Chamber of Horrors at Madame Tussauds and, you know, seeing all the paraphernalia that they had on display at the Tower, which was quite frightening.
Well, I can remember both Madame Tussauds and the Tower, I think they had fake blood on display. I can remember being 5 years of age, Mike, being brought down to London for the first time. And I don't think I was scared. I just thought, well, you know, that's a display and it's fake blood.
I think it had a deep impression. But what's interesting is when you think of, you know, we were just watching the end of Dracula on the box, and you think how violent our culture is, how violent entertainment is. Mm. Kids play video games, which are unbelievably violent, you know, blood on the screen, shoot 'em up games and all this stuff. And then there are some people saying, oh, no, we mustn't expose them to this terrible stuff at the Tower of London, which is part of our history. And this attempt to sanitize reality actually reflects something deeper and rather weirder going on in our culture.
Well, I suppose the answer to it is, if you're afraid that it may scare you or anybody who's with you, then don't go. It's the Tower of London. It does what it says, you know, on the tin. We can't change history. We can't rewrite what happened. And what happened was, you know, those who were seen to be enemies of the realm sometimes met a rather gory end at the Tower of London. That's history. How far do you go to sanitize history? Not just there. You know, it's a bit of a worrying trend, I suspect.
It is. It's a very strange impulse. I think as we're, you know, getting on this evening, I cannot resist but share one of my more intriguing Tower of London stories, because one of the first places I ever had a job was the Tower of London. And I'm going back to the 70s now, and there was a medieval fair on in the moat of the Tower of London. And I actually had the job, if you want to call it that, of coming on between the jousts and putting on a crossbow act with a crossbow, where I'd sort of shoot a balloon off a dummy's head.
Well, near a crowd of people.
Oh, yeah, very near.
Health and safety, I would have thought, Mike.
Yeah, oh, yes, this is where this story goes wrong. I was 17 or thereabouts and about to head off to the Guards Depot in the army. But anyway, I thought that there was amazing commercial opportunity with this. So after the show, I set up Michael's crossbow shy, where for the then grand sum of 50p in the currency, the decimal currency wasn't that old at that stage, you could come and have a go with a real crossbow. Now, this seemed like a very good idea, and I was, you know, raking it in hand over fist, appearing at the underground station in the mornings, by the way, with two crossbows on my shoulder and dressed in green tights, which brought some interesting comments.
Well, I would imagine you would be, you know, if you stepped out of a tube station with that particular paraphernalia around your neck today, you would probably be 30 seconds away from pinning to the ground and arrest, and quite understandably. But these were different times.
Probably.
Different times we're talking about.
And it gets better, because I then discovered that there might be a commercial opportunity in doubling the number of crossbows. So I invited a girlfriend to be the magician's assistant, and we decided to have two crossbows. Big mistake. I was showing someone how to fire the crossbow, and I heard behind me the unmistakable twang of a crossbow being discharged. Span round and saw a 10-year-old boy with a big smile on his face holding this thing up, having just discharged a real crossbow.
Well, I suspect that probably, I mean, we're talking about 40-odd, just before anybody starts to get a bit worried about this and says, what's he talking about? This is like 40 years ago, where people routinely smoked on the bus, you know, where people used words and phrases that they should not have been using, but they did back then, and this is a different era. You know, we're not suggesting that anybody does that now, but that's astonishing. I presume the crossbow act stopped then pretty quickly after that.
Oh, no, it gets better.
Oh, does it?
Health.
Well, we have to be a little careful about how much better it gets, Mike, but
yes, health and safety definitely was not satisfied, and it was a very dumb and a very foolish thing to do, but you do those things when you're young. Anyway, I was waiting for the sea of people to pass, because it just looked as if someone had to get hit by this wretched crossbow bolt, which had just disappeared into a sea of 5,000 people or whatever it was, and nothing happened. And I waited, and nothing happened. And I waited some more, and nothing happened. So eventually, very quietly, I traced the trajectory of the crossbow bolt. And I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it. And then, after about 5 to 10 minutes of serious looking, I saw it on the ground, sticking into the ground, into the grass, about 45 degrees, where it had thankfully landed safely, but between the ankles of a beef eater.
Oh, my Lord. So yeah. That was, I mean, thank goodness the fire of this was not very tall, and presumably that's why it ended up between his ankles.
Well, I don't know, but how one's life might have changed.
Well,
beef eater shot.
Well, it's quite likely we would not be having this conversation, but it just goes to show the things that were acceptable that we didn't, you know, we didn't do a complete double take about all those years ago. But then, of course, it's a question of how far you go, isn't it? So today we're talking about, because of the exhibits are seen to be a bit gory, you know, they're said to be maybe just a little, you know, a little too much for some people to take. So on one end of the spectrum, 45 years ago or more, there's you with your crossbows, and thank goodness we're not doing that anymore. And then today we've got people saying, there's a little bit of blood in a bowl there, and some rags and a knife, depicting how some, you know, medieval person or whatever it is met their end. That's much too much for us to take. I think there's a happy balance somewhere between those two, I think.
There is, and I would say that I think we've taken health and safety far too far. It's become obsessional in some places. I think in those days we did learn.
It's still good that we don't do crossbow sessions, though, isn't it?
But probably it is. But I mean, we did learn by our mistakes. But coming back to this point of the squeamishness of people today, there is a sort of schizophrenia in our society, isn't there? Because on the one hand, you do have entertainment, which is incredibly violent. You have a lot of street violence as well. You have a lot of stuff happening, which is really very nasty. And then the idea that you should somehow prevent your children having any sense of reality or of history. There's something really rather weird about that, something potentially unhealthy about that.
Well, I suspect it's part of this. I mean, I don't know. Maybe my listener can tell me on 03444991000, but it's kind of this complaint culture. There is always something to complain about. I don't know. I mean, I'm glad that I wasn't around 40-odd years ago when people were willy-nilly firing crossbow bolts around. But if you think about what was on television in those days, Mike, there was a television program called The Golden Shot. And The Golden Bernie the Bolt, was all about people phoning up a live television program on a Sunday afternoon and directing a television cameraman whose camera was connected to a crossbow to fire at an apple. And if they hit a golden thread that ran through, God knows how I remember this, they hit a golden thread that ran through the middle of the apple, there was a shower of coins that would then, you know, appear, and that person would win £5,000 or something. I think we have progressed since then.
Possibly, although I have to say, I thought that program was great. It was probably why I bought the crossbow.
Well, no, it was mainly great because of Bob Monkhouse, I think.
No, I mean, he was a brilliant entertainer, a brilliant host.
And, and following him, the wonderful Charlie Williams, old flower. But this is going back way too much. Mike Yardley, lovely to speak
with you. All of that stuff does show you how our value set has changed enormously.
I think so.
A lot of people will be listening to this and thinking, You know what? I remember that, and it was quite good fun. And where did the fun go? In some ways, we're living in a society now where I think, because we're trying to protect everyone from everything, some of the fun, what the Germans would call the Schmecht, has gone from life. Some of the taste has gone from life.
I tell you, we come back to the point that I think is at the heart of all of this, that, you know, there's a happy medium somewhere, really, between being silly and taking risks with people and allowing people to experience things that may be part of our history or things that they should experience. And it's a question of getting everything into perspective, I suspect.
I think there is. And I think there's another point as well, though, and particularly with kids. I mean, kids do stuff. I mean, I did dumb stuff when I was a kid. You did. When we were teenagers, we probably did some very dumb stuff, stuff that you probably wouldn't even death.
Well, you know, I was talking the other night about how you could buy fireworks just at your local newsagents back in the day. And I used to, when I was, you know, 8, 9, and 10 years of age, I would buy fireworks. Then I would go down to the beach at the bottom of our road in Liverpool. And I would then do, you know, explosive demolition jobs on the sand dunes.
Absolutely.
And when you think about that, you know, it's horrific that we were able to do things like that. Thank God we have controls on those things now. Mike, listen, I'd love to talk with you for longer, but we're out of time, and I wish you a very happy new year.
And you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the story. Mike Yardley, historian there. We were talking about the Tower of London and people going there and saying it's far too bloody. If you go to the Tower of... I mean, there's a place in Perth, Western Australia. Very quickly, I'll tell you. I visited for a radio show. Somewhere on my website, there's a picture of me standing by the gallows at Perth Prison. Okay? And you had to go and visit that to understand the way that people behaved back in those days. Doesn't mean that anybody's going to do that now. I think it's just a question of balance, as most things are. This is Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Get up to the minute developments of all the top stories. Late nights on Talk Radio.
Now that's what I call music. Volume 12. Howard Hughes at Talk Radio. Our number here, if you want to join in, is 0344 499 1000. We would love to hear from you.
Such a good feeling, that's where I wanna be, yeah. Locked in your prison, a total ecstasy. All right, all right.
My friends in Newcastle say incognito. I can't say that. I'll do the Liverpool for you, incognito. What a great tune that is. Well picked, Alex, my technical operative tonight. See, these shows across the holiday period, you find yourself thrust into situations where you're working with people you've never worked before with, and you may never work with again. And you, it's almost like being, you know, I've got friends who worked on the pop pirate radio ships like Tony Blackburn, people like that. And they will tell you tales about how, you know, you're thrust into the situation and you've got to get on because you're at sea and you're doing radio. That's how it is, really. James Harwood, nice to hear from you, James. I hope it's all nice down where you are. James says, nice to have you sitting in for Ian Lee for the last couple of weeks. Don't get used to it. The man is back next week. One more night. It's going to be me and Haley versus you and your friends tomorrow night. And we're just going to see where it goes, really. Nat, we were talking about the Tower of London and how, according to people reviewing the Tower of London on TripAdvisor, are getting scared, or say that their kids are getting scared, and maybe some of them are getting scared, by going to the Tower of London and seeing exhibits that might be frightening. But if you go to the Tower of London, I know this is 2020, and I know that people's sensibilities are a little bit more, you know, they're a little bit more cranked up than they used to be. But you expect to see, you know, don't you, axes and perhaps, you know, vats of fake blood and tales of people dying in the most horrible way on the rack. I would have thought, if you go there and get frightened, then what were you doing there in the first place? I don't know. Anyway, Nat says, I have an obsession about the Tower of London and its bloody history and the Beefeaters. I love learning more about it. I love history, says Nat. I can't wait to take my niece and nephew when they're old enough. Well, I think they should see that bit of history, because I did when I was five. And it didn't do me any harm. I'm all right. Apart from the twitch that I've still got. No, only kidding. You're absolutely right about that, I would say. You know, how far do you take, you know, my, I don't know, does this still happen? Do parents still take their kids to sites of history, castles and stuff like that? My mum and dad used to take me along the North Wales coast to a place that's still there called Gurwick Castle. Now, if you're listening in North Wales, first of all, land of my father's, nice to have you there. Why didn't you call? 03444991000. Gurwick Castle, though, was a wrecked castle. But it was a stately home as well. But back in the day, it was in a state of real disrepair. So my parents would take me there, and it was a bit rough and ready, and it was a bit smelly too back then. I think they've improved it now. I think they've done some work on it. I don't know. Or whatever. Chris says, I agree with your previous guest. We have become far too risk averse and health and safety obsessed in this country. The kids of tomorrow will never be able to judge risk for themselves. I don't know. Maybe they're smarter than we think, I think. But I don't know. We seem to want to wrap them up, in cotton wool for their own good too much these days, says Chris. I don't know. I can remember having go, I mean, look, you can tell me this. Maybe you can talk to me about some of the stuff that, you know, when we were kids, and I'm not talking about 1,000 years ago. In my case, it's 1970s, which is, you know, I realize that's a long time ago when I was a child, but, you know, that's just the fact. But 1980s, when kids would go out and, you know, freely cycle and cavort wherever. And, you know, sometimes things would happen. I can remember cycling into a wall. If I cycled into a wall like I did when I was 11 now, then I would probably be replete with broken bones. But today's a different kettle of fish, really, today, isn't it? Do you not think? Or am I just overthinking it? I don't know. Shane in Sydney, nice to know that you're there, Shane. And yes, we played Suspicious Minds just for you. And we did get into the delicate, but I feel necessary, topic of conversation of people who expire in the bathroom. I mean, sometimes, you know, literally, you know, in the bathroom, you know what I'm saying. Ex-Met Fed, I know who you are. Thank you for keeping the faith. Says, most of the sudden deaths I went to were in, I mean, this is just fact. This is, you know, life fact we're sharing with you here. And don't tell me you've never wondered about this, because I bet you have. Most of the sudden deaths that I went to, ex-Met Fed is a former police officer, we're in bathrooms. The morning strain is what tends to cause a burst vein.
Ooh,
apparently.
Morning strain.
Well, no, if you have to, you're probably too young to know that feeling.
I get what he's alluding to, yes.
Yeah, bestie, you're too young to know this, but you know, sometimes you've got to go quickly in the mornings, because it's an awfully long night. So I'm going to have to be careful tomorrow, won't I? But there may be a more innocuous explanation to the whole thing. Graham in Glasgow. Hello, Graham. So says one reason why so many people are found in the bathroom, I was told, is because they go in there for a drink of water, innocently.
Oh, so it's not actually the...
And then perhaps just the act of cranking the tap.
Yeah, so it's not actually the causes them to go to the bathroom. No, the bathroom's the first place you go.
I have a feeling it's a mix of many things.
Yeah.
I don't know, really. Yeah, it's something that I haven't discussed on the radio before.
No, well, this is the great thing about this show. You'd have thought that this is what we'd be...
Well, exactly.
I can't even remember how we got here.
You know, and you're supposed to be producing, and here we are going down off all sorts of avenues and alleyways, as a great man once said. I don't know. And maybe they go for a, as you quite rightly say, Graham, you know, they maybe go for a glass of water to take with the pills that they're taking, or whatever. And it just happens that that particular moment arises.
Or slipping in the shower. Which is something I'm terrified of.
Are you?
Yeah.
Have you not got a little, one of those little rubber things?
No, I haven't. I've just moved house, so at the moment it's all a bit there. So I need to get those little sticky things you put on the bottom.
What do you do?
Yeah, because that's my biggest fear, of you slipping in the bathroom, in the shower, injuring yourself so you can't get up, and then someone will find you, obviously, in the state of showering, and you can't get... Oh, just nightmares.
A young thing like you has actually been tormented by the thought of expiring in the shower.
Not so much expiring, more getting stuck or like dislocating your shoulder. I know someone that dislocated their shoulder in the shower by slipping
over. Very easily done.
Yeah.
You know, when you're not as lithe as you used to be, which goes for me. I slipped about a month ago, and it was only slight. I was trying to, because I still have I talked about my flat that is in need of much refurbishment. So I still have a bath with a mixer tap attached. I'm proud of it. But you know, it'll all have to go. But every so often...
You're getting all redone.
If I'm busy, then I'll get out of the bath quickly and I may slip. And I did slip. And I only just wrenched this shoulder here, this one.
Yeah.
That one there. Very slightly. And the pain that it wasn't when I did it. It was the next day.
Oh, it always is for those sorts of things.
No, I don't know. I'll tell you, it's one of those. Oh, 0344-499-1000 is our number here. If you've slipped in the bath, no, I'm only kidding. Have you made a New Year resolution the other day that you've already broken? Or conversely, spinning the mirror and showing you the other side of the coin, did you make a New Year resolution last year and you've only, you've managed to keep it going? I suppose this is what I'm saying. You managed to keep it going until now.
I've got a New Year confession.
Have you?
It's not quite
a
New Year.
It's safe to tell after 11 o'clock.
It is. It's not quite a New Year. I hope my boyfriend isn't listening. Well, no, he also broke it as well.
Okay.
But
Did you break this thing together or was it in
separate? Yes, he was the accomplice in this.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been trying to be vegan for the past couple of months now. And I've been vegetarian successfully. Over Christmas, the cheese got to me and I had some cheese. And I also had some cream on my sticky toffee pudding, which also wasn't vegan. Basically, I lapsed over Christmas, but I was like, it's fine because I haven't had any meat. So I haven't had meat for nearly 6 months now. I've been really good. And then, do you know what I had last night? Day after New Year's Eve, I wasn't feeling 100% chicken tikka masala.
Okay. Was that a good idea?
Well, as you know, I wasn't feeling very well the day after either, but I do regret it a lot now. I'd gone so far. I hadn't had turkey, and I really like turkey.
I think there's a good reason for this. I don't think there was anything awry or amiss with your chicken tikka. I think what happens is when you start going veggie or vegan, your system adjusts to it. So if you assail it with chicken or pork or something, all that stuff that I love, if you assail it with
really
any of that stuff,
agree with me.
Then your system is going to go, what is that? And you're going to have problems, as you did.
Yeah.
I mean, but I'm so surprised that you're here tonight, to be frank.
I feel like I've let myself down. I'm actually very upset that I cracked. Because I even said on New Year's Eve, I'm actually going to take it really seriously vegan. Like I've been half-assing it. I'm going to take it seriously, and I'm really going to dedicate it. And it lasted a day.
Maybe one of my listeners, maybe you, will know that joke about the three balloons, the mummy balloon and the daddy balloon and the baby balloon.
I don't know this one.
And the baby balloon insists on getting into bed with his mother and father, and they say, all right, then get in the middle here. And he lets a little bit of air out of both of them. And they wake up in the morning and they say, we're disgusted with you. You've let your mother down. You've let me down.
I do know this one. I just didn't know the start of it.
I did tell you, didn't I, that I'm not a comedian. That was it.
No.
Did we mention Shane in Sydney? Yes, we did. I just need to be sure. We're going to be talking at some point about showbiz. A little later this hour, we'll be catching up with Jeannie Wolfe, my friend in Los Angeles, California, who is probably the world's best known showbiz correspondent. Whenever anybody famous dies in Hollywood, It's normally Jeannie they go to first, because Jeannie never sleeps.
Really? She knows everyone. Turn on the news channels, one of those people?
You put her on the news channel, she's there. You know, Jeannie has been doing this for decades. I don't know how she does it. For years I talked with her on the phone. Only met her once. When I was actually going out to the Cannes Film Festival was on, and I was doing it for radio. I wasn't covering the festival. I was just broadcasting from Cannes. And Jeannie was there. We had lunch on the croissant.
So you actually met her?
On the croissant, the croissette or whatever.
That happens so much in radio. There must be so many people you know really well over the phone, but who you've never met in person.
I think for both sides, it's probably a shock. You know, when they see the reality. The rattled reality. Yeah. Here I am, this smooth, urbane character. And then when you meet me, it's a terrible shock.
That's why
I, you know, when I come in the studio, I turn the lights down and I try and arrive incognito. People say, why do you have a scarf around your neck?
You always have a scarf. It is cold in here, though.
Well, no. Yeah, you're wearing a coat. I don't understand this, but whatever.
It is chilly.
0344-499-1000 is your number. If you're one of my unexplained listeners, you have an unexplained story, you are very quick to send me emails with them. But, you know, come on now. 0344-499-1000. If you are in some far-flung place abroad and you would like to share an unexplained story, maybe something, I don't know. You know, we had Angela on before and she talked about the haunted bathroom she has at her home. Maybe we could talk about that.
Yeah.
Maybe there is a haunted, is your house, let's cut to the chase here. Is your house haunted? Do you think that there are spirits and a presence there? And I have shared this once with you before, but I'll share it again. For the sheer hell of it. I once saw in my parents' house what I thought was an alien. Okay, now I think I'm reasonably well balanced, you know.
First got you into...
Well, not necessarily, I just didn't know what it was, but I looked at the corner of my eye one night, I was 17. And I think I was quite a rational young person, and I looked at the corner of my eye and the... what I saw was long and spindly, long fingers, possibly six of them. You think I'm joking, either? Yeah, it's true.
No, look, I've got goosebumps. I'm a real wimp. I do not like scary stories. I wouldn't make it in the Tower of London.
And this thing had a long head like a classic alien and was very spindly. And when it realized that I'd seen it, it jumped back. True story.
Jumped back where?
No, jumped back behind. Well, you've got a door frame.
Yeah.
It's the other side of the door frame, and I can see half of it. And once it realizes, you know, once it realizes...
Ooh, that's really spooky.
He's, you know...
My mum believes in ghosts.
Colette in Liverpool, thank you very much for your text. Now, why don't you give us a call? It'd be nice to hear from you. Loving the Scouse chat.
Oh, fellow Scouser.
No, Colette has got a photograph of my dad, your dad, Colette, pretending to throw me off the top of a Welsh castle. I am laughing. He's pulling a funny Boris Karloff scary face. This is what mums and dads did back in the day.
If you posted that on social media today, could you imagine the you'd get told off for being
And that's exactly what Colette says. She said, I was just wondering how that will be, you are psychic, how that will be interpreted on social media now. People should know that children love risk and scary things as long as it's done in a funny and loving way. They're cleverer than we give them credit for. Colette, you know, that is the kind of logic that I expect from one of my fellow Scousers. Colette, what do you make of this story, though, in the Mirror that I was talking about top of this show about Scousers atop the love cheat table? I don't think that's true. I think they're just being honest, and I think the rest of the country are just not honest enough to say so. That's what it is, and that skews the figures, is what I say. I notice you're keeping quiet, bestie.
I'm not going to comment on this one.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, thank you for your text. Yeah, I think you need a cold shower more than anything else. Can't tell you what that was.
Oh dear, no, I won't look at that one.
No, it's neither here nor there. But Anthony, I recommend that. You know, cold as you like. You'll thank me for it in the end. So anyway, Howard Hughes at Talk Radio here. The Unexplained. Some of you have been asking me, is The Unexplained coming back? Of course it is. We are back on Sunday with, I'm already compiling the news stories with the help of Reese, my producer. We're trying to get people to talk about them. And I can give you a little sneak preview that one of our guests on Sunday is one of the most famous investigators of UFO reports in the world. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center, very well known. He'll be on the show between 10 and 1 o'clock on Sunday, which is an acre of time away. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. What else have we got here? Donald Trump. according to a story that I read just before I came in here. New York Post says Donald Trump has sent more tweets in 2019. They obviously have counted them, tabulated them. He's doubled his number of tweets in 2019. Well, thanks to Harrison. Harrison, if you're listening, it will be nice to hear from you tonight. Harrison was when I was doing one of these Ian Lee fill-ins. You won't know any of this because you weren't here, bestie. But Harrison enrolled me for Twitter, signed me up, set me up a Twitter account.
Got you with the times.
So I'm Hughes on air. Oh, hang on. We've got a ghost story. We've got to get to this.
Ooh.
Yes, thank you, Alex, my technical operative. Simon, how are you? Simon, can you hear me?
Good evening. How are you? How are you doing?
I'm very good. And how is life treating you in this new year? It's
very
only the
well.
2nd of January.
Very well. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Simon. My technical operative tells me that you've got a ghost story. Are we right about that? Are you going to chill our bones?
I'd certainly. Oh, I hope so. And first of all, I want to say you've got the best voice on the radio.
My boss may not agree about that, but thank you very much, Simon.
Yeah. So my story is basically about maybe 20 years ago, Derek Acora used to do his ghost story stuff. Yeah.
What was that? Most Haunted, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. All that.
And he used to say, because, you know, for Liverpool as well, he used to say, hang on, in the corner there, I've just heard the noise, I can see him now. It's a Roman centurion. It's definitely a Roman centurion. Yeah, that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
Totally. And his pal Sam, isn't it? Sam, that was his sort of psychic person that he used to tap into. Well, this happened. Basically, he was doing a place in Edinburgh. I won't mention it, but it's quite a famous place.
Oh, it's not the big graveyard there, is it?
It's not a graveyard.
Okay, no, sorry.
I'm not going to use the venue.
It actually makes it more mysterious that we don't say where it is. Go on, carry on.
Yeah. It's essentially a place in Edinburgh that had the plague. Anyone that comes in Edinburgh, they'll get it. But there's the plague, essentially, it was shut off and people go and visit it. So this place was above that. So Derek Acora was in the place doing his thing. And I spoke to a security officer who was essentially patrolling the floor above it. He was doing his normal thing. And whilst he did that, all the chairs and tables moved from one, essentially where they were, whilst he did his shift, over to the right-hand side.
What, by themselves?
To a corner, by themselves.
Oh, my Lord. Well, that's either an earthquake or that's proof.
Either Derek Acora's got a giant magnet, or there's something really, and it freaked him out. And I think he ended up doing, basically quitting his job because it freaked him out so much.
If the people involved in that can verify that, I'd love to talk with them sometime.
No, this is 100% true. And the security officer, and I mean, he was, you know, he was just doing his thing. And that was directly above this part, which I'm sure you could sort of figure out. Well, I'll give you a bigger clue. It's on High Street in Edinburgh.
Right, and tables. There were like tables for guests. For people who were visiting.
Tables, chairs. They all moved to that right hand side, and he'd went and just done his sort of patrol and came back. Mm. And he was really, really scared when he came back.
Well, I think such things can happen. I told the story a couple of weeks ago here, I think on one of these fill-in shows, about how my father, when he was in the army, had to stay with his platoon or whatever it was in a house in East Anglia in a place called Thorpe Le Soken. And they had kit and rifles and stuff that people in the military have. And they slept at this place and they stacked all the kit along the landing of this house, this old house. And the next morning, and there was nobody else in the building, something or somebody had moved every single thing. And my father swears that not only did that happen, but he also saw when he got up to go to the loo in the middle of the night, there was a girl in a ghostly diaphanous robe and no feet, standing by a big window, and she disappeared through the window. The next day, he was told the true story, and there's not a word of a lie in any of this, that a girl had committed suicide years, decades before by jumping through that very window. So I believe these things, Simon. There are those who don't, but I think there's more in heaven and earth than we will ever know. Simon in Bedford, thank you for that. That's that kind of stuff we want. Or anything, really, you want to throw at us tonight. Chuck at us whatever you want. 0344-499-1000. It's myself, Bestie, my producer, and Alex doing the knobs and buttons here on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late nights on Talk Radio.
Now you're talking. Going back a bit here, but good nonetheless, don't you think? The number of times in the last 2 weeks that I've been here during the week, and I've nearly said the unexplained at Talk Radio, which of course it isn't. Even though you may have heard promotions running all day, it was just to tease you. It's not quite the unexplained. We are doing a bit of ghostly stuff here, and we will do some more a little bit later, but we're mixing it up. We're doing a bit of mixing. I'm going to be talking to a guy in a little while who's done something astonishingly brave. And we'll tell you more about that. Something that you and I suspect, could never have done. But there we are. What else? Oh, James, I forgot to mention you, in the days when I was working with Chris Tarrant on the radio, do you remember the morning when he went to throw a CD case at you? Yes, I do. And I think it hit you. Yeah. No, I can tell you other story. I don't think I've ever told this on the radio before, but twice in my radio career, I was reading the news with Chris Tarrant and he tried to set fire to my hair. That's true. But he would do it because he'd been doing stuff like that for years in a way that only just managed not to singe my hair. He would hold a lighter. Imagine doing this today. He would hold a lighter by the... You probably did. Tell me I never did that. Oh, yes, you did. He put a lighter by the side of my head as I was reading the news. And I'm trying to stay calm and composed and read the news. And my hair's about to go up in flames. And there's not very much of it. So that would be a bit of a problem, I suspect. Let's go to Joanne now. In Wolverhampton. Joanne, hello. How's Wolverhampton?
Really good, thanks.
Well, it's good to know that. Happy New Year, Joanne.
Happy New Year to you and everybody too.
So what is what's occurring in Wolves then?
It's been pretty quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty quiet.
Have you got a story for me? A story that's going to chill my bones to sub-zero?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to sit and listen.
Right, I once stayed at a holiday park near Loo in Cornwall. And we were there for 7 nights, and on the 5th night, we had a fantastic time, went to bed. Everything was all quiet. And in the middle of the night, the caravan door flew open and just a loud thud right next to me on the bedroom floor, a loud thud, and I was absolutely terrified. Got my husband, told him to check everything. He looked all around the caravan, nothing. He said it was probably the wind.
Yes.
Checked around everything. Checked their tight, went back to bed. And then lying there was an horrendous smell. And lying there, and it got worse and worse and worse. And, like, we were nearly gagging.
Mm-hmm.
And
sometimes they say ghosts smell like sulphur.
And then I says, it was all quiet. I said, can you smell that? And he says, yeah. I says, we're going to have to move. We're going to have to do something. So he gets up, puts the light on. And then it seems to disperse. You know, there's nothing. So not only
is there something that's flinging your door open in the middle of the night, there's also a strange ghostly stink.
Yes. So we open the caravan window. It's all clear. And I said to us as well, check underneath the caravan. You know, sometimes people fish, don't they? And they leave maggots underneath the vans, don't they? Tubs of maggots when they go fishing the next day.
I've never heard of it before, but I'll take your word for it.
So, you know, checked everything. Absolutely nothing. And we just gathered all the sheets and we went and slept in the living room because we were so scared.
Could you sleep after that?
No.
I'd have one eye open.
we actually got up at 7 the next morning, and you know, you leave, you like push the keys through the reception. And we left.
Of course.
It did actually scare.
Well, no, I mean, it would have scared me, I have to say. But, you know, if the proof would be if somebody later said to you, you know, that happens to people there all the time.
Yeah, I do. You know, I do think, oh, shouldn't we ask reception, you know, if anybody's mentioned anything.
Well, I suppose if you were a ghost investigator, you would say, was there any wind on that night? Had you firmly locked the door?
It was all locked, silent, you know, you go outside, clear night, silent. But the door did, you know, it was full force.
Sounds like something did not want you there.
It felt like as if you got a 6-foot man and it fell down the side of the bed. It just went boom.
Right. And sometimes these holiday parks are like either they're in or they're very close, like adjacent to farmers' fields. No farm animals around?
Well, our caravan was like centred around lots of other vans.
Mm.
So we were kind of in centralised in the middle, and then you've got lots of all other vans around you.
God.
So it was strange. Very strange.
My sister will. If you were able to talk with my big sister Beryl, who may even be listening tonight in Worcestershire. Beryl, if you're there, I hope everything's okay. When I was like 7 and my big sister was, I think she was probably only just a teenager then, we went on holiday to Coniston, you know, Lake District? And there was the biggest thunderstorm that there had been in like 50 years across the whole of the north of England and the Midlands. It was astonishing. I was only a little kid and I had no idea that such things could happen. Was I 7? Was I 9? Whatever. Anyway, there I am and I've got what I thought was the best bedroom, the best little sleeping area in this caravan. It was a little bit at the back of it, which was under a tree. And it was, you know, those just a single bedroom. Then you come forward, you've got the door into the caravan, and then straight in front of that, you've got the loo, and then you've got the kitchen and the other sleeping areas up the front.
Yeah.
But I had my own little bedroom, that tiny, tiny little thing. And that scared me like anything. And in the middle of the night, with the thunder going, and making this thing shake, we started hearing meh, 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 and the sheep from the nearby farmer's field were so terrified. And I was like 7 or 9, whatever I was scared out of my wits. But I had my dad and my mum to comfort me. But the poor little sheep had come underneath the caravan, and they were sheltering from that experience, which I don't blame. And then we went back home, and one of the things that my parents always used to get all of the Liverpool Echo. The local newspaper was always really important, you know, back in the, my Liverpool listeners will know this, like Colette. Liverpool Echo was always really hugely important to people. So if you went away on holiday, Joanne, you would get someone to keep the Echoes for you, right? So the front page of the Echo for that night was the great storm. It was the biggest storm in living memory, and it scared the bejabers out. Something else happened there. I mean, if you want to know caravan stories, Joanne, sorry, I'm talking to you now. When we were on that holiday, there were people talking about something that had happened there some years before that was a big, big national event. There was a man called Donald Campbell, and he had a car that did the speed record on water. And he was a big national hero in the UK in the 60s. And Donald Campbell had met his end on Lake Coniston. Right?
Yeah.
The Bluebird, they've recently resurrected, brought out from the depths of the lake, the car.
And they found his body.
They did find his body. They found remnants of him within it. But, you know, all these decades later when they brought it up, and there's a guy, somebody will know his name, who spent a lot of money and a lot of time restoring Bluebird, and it now works again, after all, which is a miracle, really. This thing happened in the 60s, and they said to us, you know, this is where Donald Campbell met his end. Well, I went to the edge of the lake, and I was, like I say, 7, maybe 8, maybe 9, whatever I was. And I was by myself, and it was summertime, but the water, because that lake is so cold, you know, I'm standing there, and there's a little piece of corrugated iron, you know, literally underneath the surface of the water. And, you know, when you're that age, you mess about. And I stand on this thing. I think, oh, that's like a sort of surfboard. The next thing, this thing starts dragging me down, 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 and I'm going down with it. And the father has to run across and save me. I was terrified. And I always thought it was the ghost of Donald Campbell. I'm sure it wasn't. But, you know. Sorry. So was that your only ghostly encounter then, Joanne? of all the ghostly encounters that you could possibly have?
Quite a few over the years, I suppose. I mean, we do think the house we live in is quite strange as well.
Okay.
You do hear things go up and down the stairs.
Do you?
You hear the front door click,
uh-huh.
And then you hear the bum, 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 bum.
And has that house got a story? Did anybody live there before?
I know it was built in 1930.
Mm-hmm.
Traditional semi-detached.
And whereabouts? I know Wolverhampton reasonably. I nearly went to work there. It's a long story. The radio station that doesn't exist anymore called Beacon. I nearly went to work there. Are you near there? Tetnall Road?
Bit near Mansfield Way.
Okay. Yeah. So you're the other way. Yeah.
Yeah. So we did when we had the deeds to the house, there were death certificates in them.
Really?
The deeds, and all the map and everything, and who owned it and everything, which is quite strange.
Well, you don't normally find when they finally give you the deeds. I was talking about my tiny little flat that is much in need of restoration. But I eventually, because it was cheap when I bought it, compared to today, I paid it off and I got the deeds. I didn't have any death certificates in my deeds though. Although I did have a list of all the people who'd owned that flat before.
Yeah, the deeds arrived about 6 months after we moved in. It was batteries as well. Batteries. We can't have anything with batteries in because they just go.
Well, you know what they say, don't you? They say that if you have presences, if you believe in this sort of thing, that they're looking for power. They're draining power from things.
I tried to ignore and everything, I think it frustrates my husband because we had a new boiler fitted and, have you got the thermostat that it's a wireless and you put new batteries in. It's only been there 2 months and then the battery's dead.
Okay, but that's unexplained, Joanne. Hey, listen, nice to hear from you. From Wolverhampton. Just think, I could have met you if I'd gone to work in Wolverhampton all those years ago. But it was one of those things in my life. So many avenues, so many rivers that I crossed, and so many rivers I nearly crossed that didn't. Howard Hughes here with producer Bestie and technical producer Alex tonight here on Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Outspoken opinions and decisive debate. Late nights on Talk Radio.
Oh, 0344 499 1000. This is Talk Radio. I'm Howard Hughes. Very keen to hear from you. If you've got a story like Joanne had there, things seem to follow her around. If they follow you around, we need to be knowing about it here. Now, this is a story of amazing bravery, really. And we want to talk around this because, again, this is one of those news stories that hasn't had the kind of coverage that I think it deserves. A bit like the Bloodhound Land Speed Record car that the media doesn't bother with that much. And yet that thing is about to do an 800-mile-an-hour run. That's why we talked to the boss of that project on The Unexplained. But however, having said that, I'll just tell you this from the Times today. A lone explorer is less than 500 miles from completing the longest unsupported polar journey, having on the way become the first person to climb the highest peak on the Antarctic plateau. Jeff Wilson was yesterday 478 miles from his destination, Russia's Novozhenkaya base on Antarctica's northern coast. As you may know, Antarctica is parceled out, and various nations, including the US, ourselves, and the Russians, have bases and scientific exploration portals there. Well, somebody who knows about efforts like this is Michael Sanderson, who describes himself as a survivalist. And let's talk about this now. It's an astonishing thing. Michael, thank you for coming on.
No problem, Sam. Lovely to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you, too. Antarctica, as we both know, is a massively forbidding place. You don't go there unless you've got tons of support. So putting on an expedition like this guy's done is an astonishing feat, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, just the logistics. I mean, because you're working flat out, because you're working physically, it's probably consuming 6,000 calories a day. And that's 4,000 more than you or me.
Mm. Well, and people who are on a diet are on 1,000, so that's six times more than that.
you know, I mean, easily. So imagine the logistics. I mean, all right, a lot of that food will be dehydrated and dried food, so it'll be, you know, it'll be lighter. But even so, just taking what you need to sustain life, you know, is an incredible feat in itself. I mean, I think the biggest achievement really is positive mental attitude, because we're talking about a mammoth, you know, a mammoth journey, and although he's got under 500 miles left, I mean, if anyone listening to your show had to walk 500 miles, I mean, it'd be beyond 99.9% of it.
Well, I don't even think the Proclaimers could do that, and they could walk 500 miles, but I don't think they could walk those 500 miles. We say this man is 500 miles from obtaining his objective. We have to say that it is described as an unsupported effort. What, in terms of somebody doing an exploration like that, an expedition like that, what does that mean?
It means that either his supplies have been dead letterboxed, which means that he will be making his way to supplied drops that he will be able to replenish himself at. Or we might have live letterboxes. He might have live letterboxes where there are stores where there is somebody there to meet him. But if he doesn't make one of those rendezvous, he runs out. He runs out of food. He runs out of fuel. He runs out of supplies.
And will they go looking for him?
And at minus 35, that would be fatal.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but
so,
presumably, if he didn't report at the time he was supposed to report, that a search party would be sent out, would it?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I'd be amazed if he didn't have a kind of GPS tracker on him. But then again, when you talk about any expedition that is unsupported, that's kind of what it means. It means that no one's coming to find you. It means that you are completely on your own.
Mm. What is, I should have asked you this at the beginning, but what is it he is using to get himself from A to B? Look, in the days of Shackleton, of course, they had huskies and sleds. What's he using?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't know, but I mean, I would, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised if he was walking, if he was skiing. Mm. You know, it. I mean, unsupported, I think that's what it means. It means not, you know, no mechanized assistance.
So it's just you and skis and maybe snowshoes, and that's it. You've got to get on with
it. The elements, yeah. And the mind is always, you know, 99% of the time in people, the mind is defeated first. You know, so if we look at how we train our special forces. Our army is trained with force discipline, so there are people to encourage you, to shout at you, to do anything to psychologically help you achieve the training objective. When we get into special forces, there is no praise and there is no sort of condemnation. No one's going to tell you you're rubbish and no one's going to tell you you're brilliant. They're just going to tell you to do what they want you to do. And you are completely self-reliant on getting yourself across the finish line. That's how our special forces are trained. And that mental strength is rare in extreme environments like the one this chap's taking on. There's no waking up and having a bad day.
And you have a target, presumably, for every day. And also, you know, what we have to say is that you think the weather's unpredictable here. But you go down there, and one day you may have freezing clarity, and the next day you might have a storm that will knock you off your feet.
Yeah, I mean, and there will be days when he will have to hunker down and just ride it out. You know, that it won't be possible at all to travel anywhere. That it will be, you know, hunkering down and concentrating on, you know, there's in the survival world, there's lots of mnemonics that kind of are immediate action drills, but stop is one, which is sit, think, observe, and plan. Mm. You know, so instead of throwing yourself headlong into a situation and making a catastrophic, fatal mistake because you're hypothermic, because you're dehydrated, you know, to stop, think, observe, and plan is a kind of immediate action.
Which will be part, yeah. I mean, this guy is ex-military, so that will be part of his DNA, but also he was a paramedic in the military, so presumably if he is starting to have issues, he will know.
Yeah, but the thing about hypothermia and the thing about when you become dehydrated is that it kind of creeps up on you, and with the, you know, I know of members of the Special Air Service that when they had to go back and do test week or endurance again in the Black Mountains, which is a week up there pretty much on your own, even seasoned professionals have died up there. You know, because they became hypothermic, because, you know, they were dehydrated and it just snuck up on them, and their thought processes weren't exact and precise.
As far as you're aware, and you are somebody who is, you know, used to these sort of disciplines, you know what this guy is doing. He's into the final stretch of this thing. How will, this is a silly question, but I'm asking it anyway. How will we get to know when he's actually attained it or he's close to attaining it? Presumably when he reports to the last reporting station.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing about tasks like this is, I've done similar things in my, I did 17 years in the military and I've done similar things like this. But sometimes the whole is so you just cannot perceive it. So I had days where I would wake up and I would turn around to the men around me on the course I was on and turn around and say, I'm only doing today. And people would go, oh, you know, but Mike, you can't jack it in. You've come this far. And I go, no. I'm only doing today, because I knew in my heart I could get through today. And the next morning at 6:30, I was on that truck.
And this guy has got to do more than that, because he started in November. It's an amazing feat. And thank you for talking about what that is like. I mean, we can't imagine what that is like, but we can have an idea just by talking around it, really. But Michael Sanderson, thank you very much for that. Take care. Michael Sanderson, survivalist and ex-military man himself, talking about Jeff Wilson's epic exploration. And he is within literally, I mean, when this that was written, then he was within 500 miles of his objective. Now he will be closer to it. So we will report, I hope the media will report, what happens to this man, because it's an amazing feat of endurance, do you not think? This is Talk Radio.
This is Talk Radio.
Get up to the minute developments of all the top stories. Late nights on Talk Radio.
Oh, 0344-499-1000 is our number here at Talk Radio. Howard Hughes here, normally here for the unexplained on Sundays, returning back to normal this Sunday. Be there. Coming at you in the nighttime with Bestie, my producer, and Alex, my technical producer tonight. And this is part of, how many shows have I done across Christmas? I've lost count, really. I think this is number 8. It may be number 9. But it's one of them. Anyway, it was nice to have you there. They've all been different. Well, they've all been an experience. Sunday night, The Unexplained returns. Top stuff for you. And don't forget, of course, you can always check in with my website, theunexplained.tv, where you'll find 440 or thereabouts unique podcasts that I've been compiling for years on there. And thank you very much. If you're listening to this show now, and you're one of the people who listens to those podcasts, so my website, theunexplained.tv. Now, one of these things that we've been doing over these last 2 weeks, well, I've been doing these shows through Christmas and across it into the new year, I've been catching up with some old friends. And online to us now is possibly the most famous, I would say, always, any day of the week, the most famous showbiz correspondent in the world. Beverly Hills, California is where we're off to now. Jeannie Wolf is there. Jeannie, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
It's been a year. Jeannie, it's been a whole year since we last spoke.
That's ridiculous. Where you been, baby? Don't leave me alone.
I just didn't want to bug you, Jeannie. I didn't want to. How's life been this last year, anyway?
Oh, it's been unexplained.
What, you mean you haven't been able to predict what would happen next?
Yes.
In the real world.
Possibilities, hope, disillusionment, you know, all these promises and resolutions, and disappointments. But I always want to end the new year, the year, and start the new year laughing and expecting and playing.
There was a story that I say, I'm always seeing entertainment stories, and I always think, like, the old days when I used to phone you all the time. Probably too much, Jeannie. You were always so kind. I saw a story the other day and I thought, if this story is true, then it's going to make headlines everywhere. But I didn't see it elsewhere. I saw it on one news agency in the UK. And there is a story that they're making either a documentary, a new one, or a movie about the life and times of Michael Jackson. Are you aware of that?
You know, there are several big projects out there that have been, you know, planned on or put on hold about Michael Jackson, but the big documentary about him, you know, Leaving Neverland, just changed everybody's view or changed everybody's connection to him. You know, people love his music. There was, people thought, oh, with the revelations in that documentary, they'll stop playing his music. I don't think they'll ever stop playing his music.
It's a strange thing, isn't it, Jeannie, the way that the media and the public, you know, both, they sort of divide their attention when it comes to Michael Jackson. So radio stations are still playing his music, and yet those allegations made in that documentary in this last year, you know, will always hang over him. So I was surprised that somebody was planning to do a new project about him. I don't know what kind of take on his life they would give.
Well, right now there have been so many successful music documentaries or music, you know, films, Rocket Man and Bohemian Rhapsody, and lots of, you know, I interviewed David Crosby, Linda Ronstadt. There's so many great artists that play. It's been very successful to go back to their beginnings and play that story again. And when you see little Michael Jackson taking over the stage, and when you hear the greatness, you're reminded that he was a fantastic genius and had a way to get other musicians to work with him, and he inspired people. And we did find out in, you know, the last, shall we call it, woke time, that a lot of great, more than we want to know, great, great people have a very dark, almost monstrous side. So we have to decide, what are we going to do? Are we going to cancel all those people's artistry? Are we going to try to understand that genius in its own way is a fabulous dysfunction? Or are we going to, you know, keep that separate as long as we now don't let people hurt us?
Well, I don't know how any documentary or new presentation about him would handle this. And, of course, the man himself is never going to be around again to answer the questions that so many of us want to ask. So there will always be a stain on his reputation and questions asked about and around him, whether you're the biggest fan in the world or you're not.
I was around him a lot, and I witnessed his kindness, his joy, his unbridled talent. After a while, I did not doubt that he was, in a way, a cult leader, and that he was a pedophile, or whatever you want to call it, but, you know, someone who never grew up. It was like little kids' sleepovers. But if you were the little boys and you grew up with that, you know, it would be very painful. I had lots of problems with that documentary. I found the revelations, but I had lots of problems because, just like us as fans, those men had push-pull toward Michael. They adored him. They loved him. They were inspired by him. He made their lives.
But, of course, if those things are true, Michael Jackson had a, you know, an important position. People looked up to him. And if those revelations in that documentary were so, then he abused his position. And that's something that we can never overlook or forget. But, you know, it just interested me that somebody would be up for making some kind of presentation. I don't know what it was. It made news more in America than here over the last few days, that would want to be revisiting Michael Jackson's life at this stage.
I think there are more than one big project in the works, things that were stopped by that documentary. And we'll see. We'll see what we're willing to listen to and forget. I'm sure they're testing the waters.
Well, maybe.
And they're going to see if they get money.
Maybe they will. I wonder if they will. But I was astonished that somebody would plan that in the light of what we saw on television in this last year, which was, you know, by anybody's estimation, shocking. 2019, looking back at it just for a bit, was it a year when we lost an astonishing number of famous people who touched our lives, Doris Day being one of them?
you know, I knew Doris Day and I visited her. I think that it feels like a lot of people because they were people that we knew very well. Doris Day, Diane Carroll, Luke Perry all of a sudden, Carol Channing, Peter Fonda, Albert Finney, the unforgettable Albert Finney.
Albert Valerie Finney was Harper. A genius, wasn't he?
Well, he was a genius. Oh, I remember when he did Annie and he shaved his head off. And you know what I said? Mm. That gorgeous head of hair, were you scared it wouldn't come back? What a sense of humor. What a talent. He was great. So many people like that Rip Torn, Harold Prince, Anonymous. I hate to go down this list because with each one of them, there's a story and a memory and a loss and yet an enrichment knowing that they were part of my life, part of all of our lives.
Mm-hmm. And, they become part of the pantheon of great Hollywood artists, but, you know, they're gone, and it's sad.
They're gone, yeah. Some of them had full, rich lives. Some of them went, well, I guess we all go too soon.
I think there's no doubt in that one. Very quickly, we're coming up for the award season, Jeannie. I'm seeing that Ricky Gervais is going to be doing the Golden Globes again. What's the general thought about that? I love the man, but what do you think?
It's this Sunday night. They had to have him back. The Golden Globes are thought of as more of a party. They'll believe me, they're taken very seriously if you're up for an award or if you're a studio or an actor. Ricky Gervais can do something that no one else can. He can make fun of the Hollywood foreign press. He can make fun of all those actors. And somehow, he's forgiven. He tips right up to the edge and maybe one step over.
But that's the delicious part of it, isn't it, really? And I think they get him now. I think they understand, as far as you can, I think they understand him now.
Well, because he's doing that to himself, too, while he makes fun of us and, you know, aggrandizes himself at the same time. He's making a big joke of himself. I adore him. I didn't always get him, but now I do. Now I do. I'm really looking forward to it.
Now, very quickly, Jeannie, and it's lovely to speak with you again, and we will talk in future because we've been talking now for 20-odd years. What's your hot Oscar tip for this year? Which one do you think is going to grab it, or is it too soon to say?
It's too soon to say. You've got two, maybe call them old-fashioned, big movies, Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, and you've got Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with Quentin Tarantino. And so everybody's trying to sort of play up the greatness of their film in a little bit of a pity play. Quentin Tarantino's never gotten an Oscar. Martin Scorsese says this may be his last film. Brad Pitt, who's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I adored him in it, is, you know, he's never gotten an Oscar gold. J-Lo did Hustlers. You could say she stripped for gold. And she's very likely to get a Golden Globe. And then there's Parasite, this kind of crazy Korean film like nothing you've ever seen. And the fact that it is nothing like nothing you've ever seen has gotten a lot of attention. So, this is, once again, unexplained. It's anybody who tells you they know who's going to win, including Adam Sandler for Best Actor. Anybody who tells you they know who's going to win, you just step back and think, that's a little science fiction. There's no way of knowing.
If anybody says they think they know, I'll send them round to my Auntie Jeannie in Los Angeles. She knows.
And say, Auntie Jeannie, I always say, keep your money in your pocket because there are no sure things. And also because there's so many, the variety is just insane, insanely wonderful, actually, the variety of what we're choosing. Renee Zellweger and Judy Garland, things that people are talking about, some talking about them greatly, some saying, what the heck was that? So it's always that way. It's Hollywood, and what makes someone win is a lot of things besides a great movie or a great TV show. I call it a crush. You know, you got to fall in love with a TV show or fall in love with a film or a song. And then you'll vote for it, you know, even if you have doubts. And it also helps if you're in love, if you got a crush on the people, if you worked with them, if you worked with Martin Scorsese, if you worked, you know, with some of these people, then you're rooting for them. So it's much emotional and completely not objective as it is what makes a really fine work of art.
Well, we'll check in with you in a couple of months then, Jeannie. Listen, thank you for doing this for me, and thank you for all those years of helping me out, Jeannie. We'll talk again. Take care.
I wish you lots of bubbles.
And I return them across the Atlantic and across the great continental United States, as they say. Jeannie, thank you so much. Take care. Night-night. Jeannie Wolfe, this is Talk Radio.
This is Talk Radio.
Get up-to-the-minute developments of all the top stories. Late nights on Talk Radio.
Thomas Dolby, Blinded Me With Science. What a great tune that is. If you get a chance, check out the video, do that. There's a guy there, the man who says, Blinded Me With Science is a man who used to be a TV professor on TV. Magnus Pike was his name. And you know, if you're of a certain age, 70s, 80s, Magnus Pike was always doing educational programs about science. He was a little guy who used to wear a tweed jacket and say, and the most amazing thing about this is how this works. Like that. We don't have people like that now. But check it out online. Anyway, if you want to. Colette in Liverpool, if you're still there, I take your point about this survey that says that, well, according to the survey, we have to say that Scousers are the biggest love cheats. And you say the problem with us from Liverpool, and I include myself here, is that we can't hold our own water. In other words, we don't keep a secret, which is the point that I made at the beginning, isn't it? That we're honest. It's true. And you have to take what we say with a firm pinch of salt. I think you're right, Colette. Thank you for that. Kev in Waltham Abbey, and no other similar sound in Waltham. Nice to hear from you on the Twitter, at Talk Radio. Kev says, fantastic show as always had. Well, let the boss be the judge of that, Kev, but thank you. Love to hear those spooky stories. We'll hear more soon. Martin's got a ghost story. We'll hear from him in a bit. Also, we'll be talking about Area 51 a little later this hour, but it's all still to come. And Kev says, I was thinking about taking a camping holiday in a caravan, but after hearing what Joanne had to say in the last hour, maybe not. Now, I'm connecting with some people that I've known for years but haven't spoken with for a while here tonight on Talk Radio. And one such, we had Jeannie Wolfe, and another such is the Gabby Cabby, known around the world, but not as well known in his own country. Peter Franklin is a New York cabby, drives one of those yellow taxis, and he talks about life in New York to radio stations and others around the world, which is about to do with us. Peter, it's been a long time. How are you?
I am just fine, thank you. What a delight to speak to you. And by the way, I think you were the only person from over there that wasn't in our Times Square on New Year's Eve.
What was it like this year?
Let me tell you something. It's fantastic. But on one hand, it's kind of overrated. And the reason for that is it's crowded. It's cold. You're standing next to a guy who just had a garlic pizza. No restrooms. You know, all those terrible things of large crowds. So you do it once in a lifetime. I'm inviting everybody. Do it once in a lifetime, but you'll never do it again.
But, you know, people, it's one of those things, isn't it? And we have things like that here. Let's be honest about it. Some sporting events as well, Peter. Like you say, it's one of those things that you have to do. I didn't think it was as big a tradition as it used to be. I can remember the days when, what was that famous broadcaster, Dick Clark? He used to drop a ball, didn't he, at Times Square at the stroke of midnight on the 1st of January.
The ball still comes down. It's a crystal. As a matter of fact, I think it's made in Waterford, actually.
Oh. And it's still as big a deal as it used to be.
Yes, it is. It is. You get some people in life who like to go poo-poo to everything. It's not such a big deal. I went to the White House. It's not such a big deal. I went to Congress. It's not such a big deal. I went to Yankee Stadium. Yes, those are the things that are the big deals in life. So, no, it is. It's really nice. But as I say, the best way to watch it is in your hotel room, sitting on the couch where it's nice and warm and cozy.
Do you know what I love to do whenever I, and I haven't been to New York now, and you and I met once when I came to New York, and I was covering one of those anniversaries of 9/11. You and I walked around that site, which of course has now been built, and there's the Freedom Tower there now, but you and I walked, I think it was midnight, we walked around the site. But one of the things I love when I'm in New York, and it is, you know, people say New York is cold and unfriendly. It's not. It's one of the friendliest cities, I think, on earth. But I love to be in a hotel there and order the breakfast. There is nothing, Peter, and you may disagree with me about this, but there is nothing like a New York hotel breakfast.
Oh, I mean, it's fantastic. And that's how to say, watching the proceedings from a nice, warm hotel room is really the way to do it.
Mm. So, listen, you know that over here we've been caught up in an election with Boris Johnson being elected, and we've had the Brexit thing that's gone on for years. So I think we've kind of neglected our cousins across the sea there. What's the vibe off the mean streets of New York? What's going on there? What should we know?
Well, first of all, I want everybody to keep in mind that Boris, good old Boris, buddy, is a New York guy.
Yes, he is. They were born there, I think.
His father was a professor at Columbia University, one of our Ivy League schools that's kind of modeled after Yale, Harvard, Princeton, and all that kind of stuff. So there's a certain affinity between, I think, Trump and him in the sense that they're two New York guys, and that's probably why they're going to get along very, very well.
And it goes, you know, beyond the blonde hair. What does the media, what does your television say about Boris Johnson? What do they think of him?
It's the same deal as with Trump. You got to understand, I guess the best word for describing either one of them is they're weird. They're just not ordinary people.
Well, they're not like everybody else. Let's put it that way.
Exactly. And I think that's part of the charm. And that's why I always say to people, the biggest problem with Donnie, see, I call him Donnie, is that he needs somebody like me to be his buddy who every once in a while can say, hey, Donnie, shut up, will you?
I wonder if anybody can say shut up. Maybe there is somebody. Maybe, you know, Ivanka can say shut up. I'm not sure. Did you, in all of those years of driving a car around New York, and I know that you've been doing that for a very long time, and you're now doing that for parties of tourists as well, did you ever come across Trump himself?
Well, no, but I do have a connection story, and this is that we have three kids, and our youngest kid was going to the same, I guess you'd call it a Montessori school, I'm going back many years, of course, that Donald Trump's kid was going to. And so what happened is that there was a birthday party, and our son was kind of at that birthday party. So I guess it's a long bit of a stretch, but it's sort of like saying, well, that's the connection. You know, the connection was, and one day my son was at a birthday party for his son. Mm. Big deal? Nah. But I'm just trying to get some points.
That's a good story to tell, though. Trump Tower, you know, a lot of people they've seen Trump Tower on TV. But it's an experience to go and stand underneath that place, because it is, in fact, I think I even walked into the reception area, through the spinning doors there once. It's an opulent looking building, isn't it?
Well, he's an opulent looking guy. Lives in the high thing, fast lane. And that's what he does. And he happens to be, by the way, very popular in New York. He really is. I don't think that sometimes filters through with the news media. He was very beneficial in doing a lot of projects and things in New York. He was always regarded as a good employer. So, you know, a lot of the stuff that you hear about everybody hates him and they don't like him and this, that, and the other thing is not really that true. It's a funny thing. When somebody says to you, who are you voting for? You'll say, oh, I'd never vote for Trump. And then I guarantee you they walk into the voting booth, and who do you think they vote for? Mm.
And when he starts campaigning for this, you know, second term that he'd like to have, do you think he's going to come to New York fairly soon when he starts campaigning?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, because he wants to hear a lot of cheering, and he's going to hear a lot of cheering. And keep it in your mind, this is a big money business running for president. He has raised so far $46 million. You know, in the last quarter, so that the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of money floating around, which is one of the reasons people run for president.
You know, those people, you told me when we met, when I came there, that one of the things that you do is that you get booked to take tourists around New York. Presumably they come from every corner of the world. What are the things that these days they want to see? But you, when I used to go there first when I was younger, it was always the Empire State Building. And of course, in the days of the Twin Towers, you had to go and see the World Trade Center. For all the reasons we know, that's not there anymore. But what is it that people want to see?
Well, the Trump Tower is, I mean, that's usually one of the high on the list. That the, are we going to go by Trump Tower today? Because it's a fantastic building. It's at 56th Street and 5th Avenue. The first 8 floors of it, you could kind of call it a shopping mall in a way. And then above it, there are apartments where people actually live. So Trump Tower is very much high on the list. Of course, the World Trade Center. Remember, there were 2 buildings, but they only replaced one of them. That's a very big thing. But the real heart, the real power of New York City is the neighborhoods. This is probably the most segregated city on the face of the earth. And not in a racist way. Mm. It's just people like to live with their own kind. And for further information, ask a sociologist. But people like to go to Spanish Harlem, Black Harlem, the Jewish area.
And lots of places with heritage, you know. And if you want to get the best food for whichever, you know, whichever group it pertains to, then you go to New York. And, you know, I had fantastic food, Chinese food in New York, and I had great Mexican food in New York. It's a great melting pot of a place.
Yeah, I mean, of all places in the United States, I think we have the littlest amount of racism, really. People here get along pretty well.
Mm.
Howard, if you tell me where you live, you give me an address, you live at 46th Street and 1st Avenue, I'd say, he probably works for the UN. Mm.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is that people, and I know this from my own experience in my own family, and I don't think I ever told you this story, but I'm from Liverpool, and I have relatives decades and decades and decades ago who, when times were hard in the UK, and they were, I'm talking about the 1930s here, and they were as hard, if not harder, than they were there. They left Liverpool, and they went as illegals, as many people did, to live in New York, and they had a life there. They established a life. They lived in Passaic, New Jersey. And then somebody informed on them, and they were ejected, as many people were. Most of them were thrown out via Ellis Island. But, you know, the whole world is, you know, it says, bring me your huddled masses. People from all over the world have always gone to New York to try and find something else. And one, the baby who was born there, and I never told you this either, Peter, the baby who was born there, Billy, who I know as my Uncle Billy, because he was born there, he was allowed to stay. So he made his money on Wall Street. When I went to see him in the 80s, when I made my first trip to America, I went to see my Uncle Billy, and the rest of them, the rest of the family, the older ones, had all been thrown out. And people forget that those things used to happen quite routinely. So New York, you know, a magnet for everybody.
That's such a classic title for him to have, Uncle Billy from Liverpool.
Yeah,
I sense there's a movie being made right now.
Actually, he would be worth a movie, because he was. I remember going to his home, and you probably know where I'm talking about, Passaic, just across the water in New Jersey. And they had a nice home there, and it was very high up on a hill. You could look down the street, and you could just about see New York from where they were. But this guy was so into Wall Street and so into stocks, and this is before, just before the internet was part of it. So he had a Wall Street ticker, you know, a ticker tape machine in his basement. And he would check the stocks. They would go tick, 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 tick. And he'd say, look at that stock go. And then he'd be on the phone to the office. Lisa, buy me some of that stock. He was completely into it. And I think people can still go to America like they did when he was around, and when my, you know, when previous generations were around. I think it's not a myth. People can still go to the U.S. and make their fortune, don't you think?
Oh, especially in New York City. I mean, you know, you hear the expression, the streets are paved with gold. It is the land of opportunity, but not in the evenings. In the evenings, everybody is watching The Crown on television.
Very wise, too. And now, every person who drives a taxi anywhere in the world will always tell you a story about the most famous person they've had in their cab. And here's something else I've never asked you in all these years. Who's the most famous person you've had in the back of yours?
Okay. I get into the cab and to do my shift, which normally is from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m., and I go out to do my trips. Some guy gets into the back of the cab, and I like to be friendly, of course, because that leads to a good tip, hopefully.
Very important.
And I said to him, what do you do for a living? expecting I was going to say plumber, electrician, broadcaster. He says, no, I'm actually Superman. So I said, you're who? So he says, yeah, I'm Superman. So I turn around, and sure enough, it's the actor that was playing the part of Superman. I got so excited that I immediately picked up my phone and called home to speak to my wife. And I said, you're never going to guess who's in the cab with me right now. And she says, who? And I said, Oopaman. Now, the reason I said that is that's how the kids would mispronounce the name. So he said, ooh, oh, let me talk to your wife. And they had a charming conversation for the trip. I got a nice tip, and I was really very excited, just like I'm bragging to you.
So you had V. Christopher Reeve in the back of your cab?
No, 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 the second guy, Dean Cain.
Oh, really? Okay. And he actually introduced himself as Superman.
Yes, he says he's Superman. If he says he's Superman, he's Superman. And he really was.
I hope he gave you a super tip.
Well, he did okay, but I'll tell you, it's not that unusual because there's so many celebrities floating around New York that to brag that you've seen one is really not the biggest deal going.
It's just another day at the office. What's the best, would you tell me, what's the best tip you've ever had, Peter?
The best tip is when if somebody asks you to go out of the city. There's certain rates which are set to go to Brooklyn, to go to Queens, what have you. You have a meter, it's all registered. An exception will be once you drive outside the city and you kind of make the deal. Well, that depends on what time it is, what day it is, what's the hour, and things like that. So any of those few, I haven't done that many through the years, where somebody says, take me to Fire Island or take me to Ocean City, that's the music to your ears when you hear that. The problem, of course, is you're coming back empty, but at the same time, it's a nice trip. It really is.
Do you know one of the nicest things, and people don't often talk about this, but when you arrive at JFK, and if you know where you're going, then your fare to the main hotels, it's all, I think it's still the same. You can get into a cab, and it's a fixed fare.
Yeah, and the reason for that is I'm a little embarrassed to reveal it. They found that there were a certain number of cab drivers, not me, of course, who will really hike it up to a tourist, you know, and make any outlandish price. You know, if you're coming in from the airport, it's going to be $85, and that's the end of it. So it's kind of to protect the tourist from being ripped off. And unfortunately, it was happening too much. So what the city did is they arbitrarily set a fixed price, so we don't have that problem anymore.
No, it's one of the nice things because, you know, you go to other cities and you know, if you arrive, I don't know, Johannesburg, somewhere like that, you don't quite know what you're going to find and you don't quite know what you're going to pay. You're always taking people on trust. But in New York, you get off the plane, you step out of the terminal, you go to there used to be a little cabin there and a guy gives you a ticket and you get the next available cab and they show you the door of that cab. And like you say, it's $85 now. I remember when it was like 50 or so. But it's one of the nice things, and it's one of the reasons that New York is worth visiting. One of the thousand reasons why New York is worth visiting, I say.
Well, New York goes out of its way to protect the tourists because they're estimating that this year we're going to have 60 million people coming to New York.
That's the entire population of the UK.
Yeah, and that's a lot of money to be floating around, so you don't want tourists getting upset. Mm. And as I always say to people, if you ever have a bad experience with a New York City cab driver, send me an email. I'll take care of
it. You think he's joking. Hey, Peter, nice to hear your voice again. You've got a website. You want to push it?
Well, it's called Gabby, GABBY.com. And the reason for people to look at it, you may have some questions about New York. I love answering questions. You don't have to book a ride with me. It's just fun to answer them. So you go to Gabby.com, see all the stuff that's there. And if you have a question, just ask me. I love it.
Well, thank you.
I kind of like this place.
You do, and I love it too. And thank you for all of the years that you've done promoting it on radio stations around the world. But actually not in America. I think you're pretty much unknown in America, aren't you, Peter?
No, not really. I would say no. The reason for that is that in New York, you can't specifically get a specific cab. So in other words, it would be all very nice if you got out of your plane at Kennedy Airport and said you'd like to take Peter for, you know, the ride into Manhattan. It just doesn't work. It's who's ever in the line that's going to take it. So the chances of getting me is somewhat remote. But like I say, I am a friendly guy. I love answering questions. Just go look at the website. And if you have a question, ask me. I got no axe to grind.
The man's name is Peter Franklin, and he is an absolute star. Take care. Have a good day, Peter. Peter Franklin in New York City. This is Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online and on DAB.
Late nights on Talk Radio.
Wondering eyes that always seem to search out all the faces in the room. I know we try, pretend that this will work out, but lately acting's just no good. Maybe we're loyal, maybe we're not. Yeah, we got our secrets, but where does it stop? 'Cause you don't remember, and I think I forgot, that we made a choice to stay no matter what. If we're
in the nighttime, we are Talk Radio. 0344-499-1000 is our number here. You can tweet us if you want to on the Twitter, at Talk Radio. If you want to text us, it's text talk and then a space in your message to 87222, and the text will cost 25 pence, plus your standard network charge. Astonishing value. I think you'll find. Interesting to talk with you about anything, really. If you've got a New Year's resolution that you've gone and broke already, then I want you to tell me why. You can confess. Fess up here. Or maybe you set one last year and you said, I'm not sure if I can keep that going. You're still doing it now, which is an astonishing achievement. I have to tell you about mine. I'm not starting my New Year resolution until a couple of days from now. I've finished this run of shows that I've been doing over the holidays tomorrow night. It's me and Haley. Open line Friday, whatever you want to say, tomorrow night with me and Hales. Then I do the unexplained on Sunday, and then that run of shifts is over. And at that point, I will probably have the biggest glass of wine. And then I'm not going to touch any more, hopefully, for at least a month, and maybe a lot longer. But that depends on whether I can actually see it through. But that my slightly delayed New Year's resolution is that I'm going to cut back on the old Chardonnay and also try and cut back on the food if I can. You know, that two stone that's been coming off and going on for years, this year has got to be the year that it goes off permanently. Now, whether I can make that happen is anybody's guess, but I suppose it's all down to me, really. It's all about willpower. Martin in Huddersfield, how are you
hello,
keeping?
Hello, Howard, darling. Right. How are you doing?
Oh, okay. Hello, sweetness. No, you called me sweetheart last time. It was really nice.
You've got a good memory. See, tell me, darling, how's your tinnitus?
It's still ringing. Have you got it?
No, but I've got something I can tell you about it. Do you find it comes on with stress or is it light? Light, you know, too much light in your eyes?
I tell you, not light. I know people who get that, actually. I mean, for those who don't know, tinnitus is when you get ringing in the ears. And I had an ear infection. Sometimes people get these things. And then I had what they call an acoustic trauma. So I heard a really loud sound. And the combination of the ear infection and the acoustic trauma, this was back in 2012, meant that I got ringing in the ears.
Okay.
And I was on the radio at the time. I had to stop working for a year. I came off the radio for 1 year.
Do you know, sorry, carry on, darling.
No, it's fine.
I'll tell you one thing. I can't abide chains rattling.
No, well, that means that if you have this, I mean, it's a lot of people, I can tell you that millions of people, even in this country, the figure who have ringing in the ears of one sort or another will be in the millions. Loads of people have it. But if you get a problem with the sound, and I know what you mean, the sound of chains, or if you turn the tap on,
yeah,
and you've got the water running loudly, if that hurts, then that's part of tinnitus called hyperacusis. It's when you get very sensitive.
What's a how's a perforated eardrum? That is very aggravating. Have you ever suffered a perforated eardrum?
Well, never going through my medical history here. No, I've never had that. Only had the tinnitus, and you were asking when it was worse. Sometimes when I'm stressed, like before I started doing these shows, I knew they were all going to be different, and
yeah,
I knew it was going to be a bit of a challenge, and my tinnitus, the ringing in my ears, got worse because I was stressed about doing this. That's the truth.
I watch Dancers with Wolves, and one of the actors in there had chains on his hands, and the rattling of the chain, or even on television, it perforated me. Everything in my ear sounded really crisp crystal and sharp just because I heard the tunes on television.
I think you might find that you do have some kind of hearing. It's very common. You know, these days, especially, there's a whole generation now, and I don't want to sound like your grandfather, but there's a whole generation now that are overdoing it with sound levels into their ears. And I was just talking with my producer, Bessie, really, about that.
To ask you about...
Oh, yes, yeah, go on then.
Things that have happened. Can you remember... 20 years ago,
only
when
just
there was a story of statues drinking milk.
But the statues drinking milk and the statue of the Virgin Mary weeping blood and stuff like that. That comes around and goes around a lot.
The only thing is, I was listening to radio that day, and people was ringing in the radio station saying that it happened to them. That was in England, and the phenomena was around the world. But the only situation was. I didn't believe it. I thought it was something I misunderstood until about 2 years ago on Radio 4, and they were stating that in 1995 statues of elephants were drinking milk. Because something to do with, is it a Buddhist religion?
I think so. It's something that I think has been reported. I haven't got the documentation here, obviously, but I think it was something that's been reported over the years in India. There have also been reports of statues that appear to move. As you stand and look at them, and there'd be mass sightings in different parts of South America, places like that, where groups of people have stood there and they've watched a statue move. Now, whether that's, you know, like the effect you get in the desert or in a hot place on a hot day, and the air shimmers a bit and you look at stuff and it seems to be moving, whether it's that. And sometimes I think, you know, it's sometimes the effect of a lot of people all together, all believing the same thing. And let's not, you know, diss or knock the ability of a group of people all thinking one thing to actually make a change. I think those things can happen.
The only thing is, right, I've come a lot of spiritual, I've come across a lot of spiritual things in my life, but that day, you see, I've got schizophrenia and I'm a silly schizophrenic, I'm not a violent one. And, that day I put some, stuff on step outside my door. And the next morning I woke up to look at, well, I went out to see, you know, if the stuff was still there. Now, I know it doesn't make sense to you, but, there was some, like, a protein in this cup that I left out.
Mm-hmm.
And I drank this protein, but I had to think, am I going to drink it or not, see? And the thing is, the same day the statue started drinking milk, you connect to that. And I was in hospital about 10, 15 years ago, and, through that protein that I drunk, I had my blood test because I've got diabetes. But the nurse, she pricked herself on one of the needles, and she did it deliberately. And I'm thinking, you know, how is it possible that the nurse would inject herself deliberately when she knows a needle's been in me?
So Martin, are you sure that happened? I would very, very much doubt that. Maybe you thought you saw that and it was a different procedure. I'm not sure.
It did happen because what happened was when she did that, she had to go and get a special nurse or a doctor to come and take a blood test. Because I was leaving hospital that day because I'd been in 8 days. And it happened about an hour before I left, so she had to go get this doctor.
All right. What you should have done at the time then, if that is the case, you should have told somebody though, Martin. No good telling me all these years later. But it's nice to hear from you, Martin. As always, the clock is ticking down on us constantly. But Martin in Huddersfield, you please take care and Happy New Year. And in Liverpool, talking about the greatest city on the planet, my friend Kev Seed has texted. Now, Kev Seed, in the northwest of England, is a radio legend, and anywhere in this country, as far as I'm concerned, actually. And Kev says, a little message for 2020, says, I'm giving up deodorant. I'm not going to spray the stuff anymore. Roll on next year. Kev Seed, that's the reason why we need you back on the radio soon. I hope you're doing well. This is Howard Hughes with producer Bestie and technical producer Alex tonight here on Talk Radio.
Outspoken opinions and decisive debate. Late nights on Talk Radio.
And you can dance. No, I can't.
For inspiration.
Not even for that.
Come on.
No, not for all the money in the world. Maybe for a lot of money. Ooh. Stand by. It's Howard Hughes of Talk Radio. Hey, did I read? Was I right that Madonna's not very well at the moment? I think she's got some kind of injury. My producer, Bestie, will check that. But, well, we wish Madonna all the best. If you want a showbiz story, and I tell this against myself, back in the day, Madonna did, when she had the fantastic Ray of Light album out, she did an exclusive gig just for, like, people in the music business and people, like, sort of in the sort of London. And I was on the radio in London at the time, and I got a ticket. So I went to the Brixton Academy, and I saw Madonna live debut the album Ray of Light. It's the year 2000, I realize that. It's a long time ago, 20 years ago, at the Brixton Academy. So, and she was fantastic in that. And apparently, Bestie, my producer, was on holiday in the Maldives at that time. Oh, Madonna's on holiday in the Maldives. Oh, really? I'm being told here by Bestie that Madonna's on holiday in the Maldives. Well, it's a nice place to go. I wonder where she's staying. You're not going to find out, and neither am I. Now, I did say to our unexplained listeners, thank you very much for supporting me for all these years, by the way. It's very good of you. Go to my website, theunexplained.tv. Check out my podcast there. You will not be disappointed. The latest one is with Paul Sinclair, the man who does the Truth Proof investigations in the East Riding of Yorkshire. If you want to be chilled tonight, you might want to try that, but not right now, because we've got an awful lot to go. And then there's another program after us, so, you know, but check out my podcast sometime. Now, one of the stars of The Unexplained over the year has been a filmmaker called Jeremy Corbell. He was the man that I spoke with when he was live and standing outside the gates very nearly of Area 51 earlier this year, when the Storm Area 51 campaign was on. He's also a man who's made a documentary about a man called Bob Lazar, mysterious man who has claimed for many years that he worked at and was involved in the back engineering of alien technology at Area 51. Well, I spoke in a recent conversation with Jeremy Corbell about Bob Lazar and about that documentary. Bob Lazar is a man who was very prominent probably 15 years or more ago when he first started to come out on the old Art Bell shows across the United States, talking about having worked at Area 51. Of course, you know, he used to take a lot of calls on air, people saying, I don't believe this guy, and other people saying, I think I knew him there. We used to get the bus into Area 51 together. And he was a controversy machine. We say controversy, I know you say controversy machine. But fascinating, and a man that I made it my business to try to get to interview. And I've been trying, like most of the rest of the world, to interview this man for the last 15 years or so. But you did it, and you did a documentary with him. And I don't know whether you're drip-feeding stories from the documentary to the media, and they're coming out, or whether the media is just slowly picking them up. But every couple of days here, we get it's a great way of doing publicity, if I may say so, but every couple of days we get another story that comes out of what Bob Lazar has said and your documentary. So, you know, congratulations again on the handling of the publicity for this.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a very natural process. As people start to absorb what's in my film, they pick up on different parts of it and then propagate the story more and more and more. And just to be clear, it was almost 30 years ago when Bob Lazar came forward on the news, KLAS Las Vegas, with my mentor in journalism, George Knapp, and they told the basics of Bob's story so Bob would be protected, because at the time he was worried about what was going on. He was a liability to the United States military. It was almost 30 years ago. Wow. But his story has not gone away, even though he's been pretty quiet about it since then.
Has his story changed in that time?
Not even by a single word. That's what's so wild. He's never sought publicity. He's never sought to try to make a fortune off of his story. He told his story, got it out. But in the lens of 30 years, as you'll see in my film, there's a whole lot of new information that does, in fact, verify a lot of what he said.
Are you paying him?
No, absolutely not. I offered to pay him. I mean, look, I spent 2 years of my life living with him for weeks at a time. He's the subject of the film. He is getting zero for the movie. He did it because he feels that you have a right to hear his story, but not the way it's being told by other people. It's being twisted and disemboweled, and it has been for 30 years. So now we're setting the record straight.
But it has to be said, if Bob Lazar had been a little more proactive himself in accepting interview requests, this makes me sound very bitter, from people like me, then this story would have been out there, and a lot of the disinformation, a lot of the dissing of this man that he claims he suffered would not have happened, would it? If he'd made himself more available before now, it's great that he's on your documentary, he wouldn't have had to suffer.
Right, but, you know, look, you have to see it from his perspective. The UFO topic has done nothing good for him. Every time he brought his head up, George Knapp would pull him out for like a couple minutes here or there. You know, he would be cut down every time. The UFO world has done nothing good for him. I would have done the same thing, making yourself available in this way. Look, he said, I said it 30 years ago. I thought I set the record straight. And it just, you have to understand it from a human perspective. He loves his life. He's not a UFO guy. He had an extraordinary experience. He didn't seek it out, and it caused so much disruption in his life. I don't blame him for not putting himself forward for 30 years.
Okay, two quick questions, and I wonder if it's possible to answer them in one answer. What does he say he did at Area 51, and what is he doing now?
Right, so I'll answer those two questions. He never worked at Area 51. He would fly into Area 51, and there's a sub-base of Area 51 about 17 miles south of Groom Lake, which is Area 51, at a dry lake called Papoose Lake. That's where they held all the non-terrestrial or alien technology. His job was to work on the power and propulsion system and try to use earthly materials to replicate these alien flying saucers, one in particular that he dubbed the sports model. That's what he was tasked for doing for the United States military. That's what he claimed back in 1989. Now he runs a scientific consulting and supply business called UnitedNuclear.com, and that's where he, that's what he does now as a scientist.
When he worked there, he says, and did all of this, did he sign documents to keep him quiet? Did he sign confidentiality agreements?
Absolutely, he did. He signed all confidentiality agreements. He was also threatened from day one that if he talked, that he would be eliminated. However, you know, what happened to him pushed him to the brink where he was so afraid for himself, his safety, and his family, his wife at the time. You know, it was a choice. He was on a razor's edge. It was a choice. Come out and say it, and then they have nothing else on me, or sit back and be fearful for the rest of my life. And he was being threatened. You might not believe it, but it's true. They were tapping the phone lines at KLAS News. Now we all take that for granted. We know that all of our communications go to a supercomputer in Utah, right? But back then, it wasn't the case. So he was being threatened. He was being attacked. He was being terrorized. And he came forward to save his own skin.
So by going public and by doing this documentary, he thinks he's not going to get a bullet in him, or he's not going to disappear.
Well, that was a long time ago in 1989. That was the original reason for coming forward. This movie, the way I convinced him, I said, look, there's so much fake news out there about you. There's so much total disambiguation with what it is that you actually said and did. Let's clear it up. There's two new generations of people that were born since you came out with your story, and they don't know your story, and they're hearing it from third-party sources who are lying. So let's just get it out right now. And we thought everything would be okay. We thought nobody cared what he said. We thought he wasn't being monitored. And if you've watched my film, you quickly find out that is not the case. Dramatic events unfolded during this film.
Who do you think is monitoring him now, and how are they doing it?
Well, we know for sure that there was a FBI raid during my film, although it was a multi-agency raid. And you actually see that unfold in my film. And how they're doing the monitoring, I don't know. Again, a very dramatic event occurred where they reported back to him our conversation that we thought was private. We took measures for it to be private. So we have some theories, and I have some federal officers who told me how it could happen. But yeah, it's pretty unnerving.
Okay, now you know the criticism of Bob Lazar over the years. Number one,
all of them.
That he never worked at the places he said he worked at. Number two, they say this man is a fantasist and this man has made it all up. What is the convincer, or what are the convincers, in your documentary?
There are so many, and you have to watch the documentary to fully grasp them. But, you know, let's start with this. When George Knapp was investigating the background of Bob Lazar, he was never able to prove his education that Bob Lazar claimed. However, he was able to talk with people who actually dropped them off at school. So now we have a conflict. But the big one, the real big one, is Los Alamos National Laboratory. 30 years ago, they denied his existence. He never worked there. George Knapp then found him on the cover of the Los Alamos Monitor, which is a local paper. Los Alamos is, by the way, a very top security facility here in America. Then he also found his name in the phone book. So he was able then to go with Bob Lazar to the Maison Particle Accelerator, where Bob worked. We've talked to people that work with him, and I found a witness a few years ago that confirmed he was in security briefings with Bob Lazar, the physicist, and he knew him. We are far beyond those criticisms. Bob Lazar was a physicist at Los Alamos at the Maison Particle Accelerator. That, for sure, is true. And from there, he got picked up to work at the base. Additionally, once he started working at the base, there were people who we know, George Knapp knew, worked there, and they put him through the paces. Not only polygraph tests, and he aced all four polygraph tests, but additionally, people that were there when he got dropped off at the base, where he'd take the bus, he knew everything about the base. But here's the clincher. He knew three times at the exact location, the exact time, that something that looked identical to a flying saucer would come up and outmaneuver anything that we have in our arsenal. And he showed people that. He showed it to them, not over Groom Lake, not over Area 51, but as a base that nobody had heard of, S4. In fact, Bob was the first person ever to acknowledge a base called S4. And it goes on and on
well,
and
that
on.
Technology may be being created there, but the thing that's hard to prove, isn't it, that it comes from back-engineered alien technology, which has always been the claim.
Well, we can't prove definitively Bob Lazar's story to everybody's satisfaction, but it's death by a thousand cuts, man. Because look, we have craft that have incredible capabilities, but we do not have anti-gravitic craft, craft that distort space-time, craft that can move without the opposition of inertia. And that is what is reported. That is what is seen. So there are so many things that have come out for now that do show us that these craft are not from here. And to give you an example, December 2017, New York Times, Pentagon released two videos. They told you we're not alone. They told you these are non-terrestrial or alien craft. And my friend, Commander David Fravor, because I broke that story twice before the New York Times, Commander Fravor, the 2004 Nimitz UFO encounter. This is a craft with no known traditional propulsion, no tail numbers, no rotors, no plumes of exhaust. This thing could maneuver and outmaneuver anything we have in the American arsenal. And they told you about it. It's called ATIP, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. And if you don't know it, it's because you're behind the times, man. Not you, but the audience. They need to get caught up.
Well, there's somebody else I'd like to interview on my program. That's Luis Elizondo, the man who ran that particular program, ATIP, that we've talked about a thousand times on this show. One of the things I think you say is a clinching piece of information is, now tell me if I got this right, there was a piece of high security entry software or gizmo or something that Bob Lazar described was a way to get into Area 51 or the high security areas. And you say that you've been able to prove that that technology, that entry technology, gizmo, whatever it was, exists. So you say that that proves that he was telling the truth.
No, I say that that is one of the thousand cuts, you know, that show us that he was right 30 years later. It's called the Identity Map. Now, this thing was not public. This was classified, right? And all of a sudden, I was able to get some images from a friend of mine who's a journalist of these devices, and it is exactly like Bob Lazar described. So this is something that he talked about for 30 years, and everybody thought he was lying. There's nothing like it. You know, there are references to this kind of thing in popular culture, but for me, it was just one of the many things when I found those photos. Wow, yeah, it was declassified, and they did use those at that time at the Nellis Range. So it's just another thing that Bob said. To him, it's no big deal. He's like, yeah, man, look, you know, gravity is a wave now. We know that. I did say that back then. He goes, but Jeremy, I had a 50-50 chance if you think about it. He's highly unimpressed with most of what I bring him to prove, you know, or disprove, you know, his story. But this, to me, was a big deal.
Okay, the story that we were going to talk about, the reason we're having this conversation, is something that appeared in the papers over here during this last week. The U.S. government says, the Daily Express here, is running tests on the remains of aliens, according to what the newspaper calls outrageous claims from a man who says he worked at the top-secret Area 51 base. Running tests on the remains of aliens. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a strange way to say it, but here's where it came from. So when Bob Lazar was working on the power and propulsion in a project called Project Galileo, that was the project for power and propulsion. There were other projects with, you know, alien technology. Another one was Project Sidekick, was about the weaponization of this technology, gravity amplification. And another one was Project Looking Glass, and this was looking at the minute time discrepancies that are caused by gravity wave amplification. So when he was there, he was reading briefings. They let him read briefings on a few other programs. One of those briefings, he was shown photographs of a vivisection alien body, and where the organs had kind of almost as if they've grown together into a single organ. So he saw this in a briefing. Now, Bob will be very clear. He goes, I don't know if everything I read or saw was true in writing. I know the power and propulsion was real because I touched it. I dismantled it. I had my hands on it. However, the U.S. government, if not other governments, do have bodies of non-humans, and these were photos of one of those bodies or two of those bodies being dissected, and they're looking at the organs. And that's about as far as it went for him. He just got to read the briefings and see what was reported, and he kind of absorbed it. And they were kind of acclimating him to the idea that what he was about to step into, the craft he was about to walk into, which he did, was not from here. But he said he didn't need it, because the second he walked in that craft, he said it felt ominous. The seats were too small for modern day human men. Everything in that craft was, for lack of a better term, alien. Everything was the same color. It was a technology not from here.
Last question for now. We'll continue our conversations, Jeremy, because you know I always enjoy them in 2019. Why is there only one Bob Lazar? Other people work there. Why aren't we hearing from them?
Right. There were 22 people in the program that he was in. Only 22 people. There's not only one Bob Lazar. There's a lot of fake Bob Lazars. But remember, right after this story came out, to investigative journalist George Knapp, award-winning, 28 Emmys, two Peabodys, Howard Murrow Awards. I mean, the guy's like a renowned journalist who you know. Six people came forward to him right after this came out to help back up the Bob Lazar story. Every single one of them were threatened to their lives. His phone was tapped at KLS, the news station, and to this day, none of them will talk to George Knapp. So look, it's really easy to silence somebody. All you got to do is threaten them with something that is horrific. Mm-hmm. And that is what happened to all those other witnesses. Now, people come forward all the time, but that doesn't mean they're telling the truth. With Bob Lazar, we know after 30 years, we can verify a lot of what he said.
Do you feel at any risk?
No, not at all. I've only been assisted, never resisted. There's no cloak and dagger thing here. I'm an open journalist. I say it as I see it. No, I feel no risk at this time at all.
And what next for Bob Lazar?
You know, he wants to go back to his normal life. He wants to run United Nuclear. He wants to be with his wife, his animals, his family, his friends. I had to pull him out to get him on Larry King. That was like unbelievable that I got him to do that. So no, he wants to go back to his normal life, run his scientific consulting and supply company. That's it. I hope he'll come with me to a few of the theatrical premieres that I'm doing, because when he answers questions, the audience loves it.
Please ask him to answer some questions from me. I'm very nice. I don't bite. And he needs to do an interview like this one in the United Kingdom, I think, for European consumption and for people all over the world who hear this. But I'll leave that with you then, Jeremy.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, and I'll always put that forward. But I really appreciate your integrity and the way that you inform your audience about these things. They're important, and it's up to everybody else to make their decision on what reality is. Otherwise, somebody else is going to decide that for you. Listen, the Bob Lazar critics have been holding the microphone for almost 30 years now. And we took the mic back with this movie, and we're not letting go. You're going to hear a lot more about Bob Lazar.
Well, I can't wait. Jeremy Corbell, independent filmmaker. Bob Lazar, if you're on your way back from the pub and you're just rediscovering this. Bob Lazar is the man who said that he worked at Area 51 and was involved in back engineering alien technology. Problem is that he is an elusive man. He does do some interviews, hasn't as yet done one with me. I've got lots of questions that I could ask on your behalf. So, Jeremy Corbell, please, as they say in Liverpool, divvy up, deliver Bob Lazar so we can talk with him on The Unexplained. Dawn in Kent, thank you so much for your lovely text. That's really kind of you. You know, doing something completely different with different people every night has been fun and a challenge over Christmas. So thank you very much for what you said. That's nice. I'll tell you, Bestie, what was said later. Bestie's my producer. Her real name's Bessie, but I call her Bestie now, because she's now my bestie. Let's take a look very quickly, and we don't normally do this, but why the hell not, at what's in the newspapers today, because it's Friday already. I'll start with the Times, Journal of Record, and the headline is Wanted, Weirdos to Shake Up Whitehall. Apparently the Prime Minister's top aide is looking for radical ideas for government. This is Dominic Cummings, of course, the power behind the throne, is looking for left field stuff. Now, this could be bizarre, and it could be really interesting. I think we'll just have to wait and see what else.
Yeah, and on the Times also, big pay rises for rail bosses behind soaring fares and delays. Obviously, we were talking about the situation with different railways, the prices going up today, and then what's going on with Southern Western Rail. So that'll be interesting.
And, of course, Northern Rail.
And Northern Rail, of course. Well, that's in some of the other pages as well.
Yep.
And the other thing on the front page of the Times, young couples put Earth before births. Earth before births. Couples are citing the environment as one of the most common reasons for not having children.
Mm, well, I can understand that. You know, I have heard people say, I don't want to bring kids into this world.
And with all the stories we hear on the news about the way the planet is going with climate change, it is quite a scary place to imagine bringing a child into.
But even as you say those words, I will get emails from people saying, this is not the truth. And that's where we're at. So we'll see what happens in 2020. Daily Express front page, Britain's £26 billion Brexit tourist boom. Okay, Daily Express, where's that coming from?
Well, we'll find out. Oh, and then on the Daily Mail, they're leading with sex offenders allowed to sign off danger list, 3 in 4 taken off register after applying to the police. So they're saying that nearly 3/4 of applicants from sex attackers who claim they no longer pose a threat are being approved, according to figures. And they say the process appears to rely on the honesty of convicts to judge their own risk.
Well, if that is so, and we don't know the full detail of that, it's in the Daily Mail and will be elsewhere, I guess, that's rather like putting behind bars a safe cracker who's not really reformed, wants to go out and, you know, break into safes again.
Yeah.
But he says, it's all right, I'm completely reformed, Squire, I'll never do it again. And they say, okay, you say you're never going to do it again. Here's the key.
I'll be interested to see what the other criteria is, because I imagine it's not that alone.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, like all of these things, there's more to it than meets the eye. But if that is what they're claiming is so, it's astonishing, isn't it? There's no other word for it. Guardian today, Friday's Guardian, revealed how betting firms rely on, quotes, VIP gamblers who lose huge sums. The Gambling Commission considering a ban on VIP schemes to help protect problem gamblers. I mean, if that is so, again, it's in the Guardian today now, then surely there needs to be some investigation into that, because a lot of people who are these very important gamblers are losing an awful lot of money. And, you know, in many cases, I'm sure they can't afford to. Who can?
Yeah. The Eye's leading with Northern Rail to be sacked for disastrous track record. So the Transport Secretary has vowed to strip the train company's franchise after it cancelled 310 services a day. I'm just going to say 310. That's staggering when their new timetable was introduced. And the political leaders in the North are demanding greater clarity on government plans. What are they actually going to do? What's actually going to happen? And what's happening with Northern Rail?
Well, Andy Burnham was speaking today, of course, Mayor of Manchester, Mayor of Liverpool was also speaking about this, what is going to happen. It's not only there, but there are other rail franchisees who have their problems. You know, in the area that I live, Southwestern Rail have had a month of strikes, and they've kept a service going through it. But it's been less than ideal as a service. And what is going to happen? Are they going to resolve that situation? If they're going to, which, you know, presumably they will at some point, it needs to be soon, because it's the travelling public who have to, you know, who are caught in the firing line of all of this. The Independent finally has this headline. This is what a climate crisis looks like. Global figures warn bushfires are an environmental emergency. This is the terrible situation in Australia. We've been watching that death toll rise and rise. And if you're listening like Shane in Sydney, if you're listening in Australia, then, you know, our hearts and thoughts go out to you, as I know that you are now into Friday. I think Sydney is, what, 11 o'clock or so now in the morning. And today is going to be the hottest day of this hot run so far. So, you know, that's going to be an issue, I think. Now, very important things to say at the very end of the show. Thank you very much. First time I've worked with Alex. Bessie, a.k.a. Bestie. Second time I've worked with you. Thank you for seeing me through this. I will return with Hayley Hayes tomorrow night, or tonight, actually, at 10 p.m. And it's going to be Open Line Friday. No guests, no notes, no preparation, just you and us on the phone. Kate Borsay is next. Be here.
We are Talk Radio.